Go.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to this Friday evening edition of Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of live liberal conversation radio coming your way. Radio that you define. Topics that you select. That is the very nature and essence of conversation radio. And that's what it's going to be. 3 hours of whatever you want, however you want it. You know the drill. What is on your mind? I've got a fun little game for us to play. And in fact, I got to figure out a way to make this a printable thing at the website, because it's too much fun not to to just keep to myself. I received from our buddy Lee earlier today my very own Walmart bingo card. Now, I don't know, you may be able to find this on the intertubes. But this just looks like too much fun. It's just like a bingo card, only you can play it by yourself, or, you know, you can take the whole family and just send them ranging over the store and pick out a prize for whoever gets the bingo first. Walmart bingo. This is just precious. So far, in the email exchanges, we've got the over-under somewhere between 6 minutes and 8 minutes before somebody yells bingo on this. You know, you have to fill up all the squares until you get to B-I-N-G-O. Five-letter word. And like any bingo card, it has a free square in the center. The free square, you have to identify someone oblivious to, you don't have to identify it, it's free. This just goes without saying. Someone oblivious to the fact that they're in your way. That is just life in Wally World. Some of the other squares that you might enjoy. I guess it would be the B column. B-I-N-G-O, yeah. Down the B column would be rat tail hairstyle, rebel flag T-shirt, dirty diaper left in parking lot, child over five drinking from a baby bottle, and someone giving away kittens. That's just the B column. Of course, you can go down, across, or diagonally. Some of the other classics, over in the, O column, someone with unbearable body odor. G column has a kid riding a bike in the store. N, entire family wearing NASCAR apparel. Also in the N column, unattended crying children. You see why the running bet is no longer than 8 minutes and possibly as low as 4 to 6. Frozen food item left to thaw in random aisle. This would almost make it worth going to Wally World. Just to go in and play. Sir, what are you doing? I'm playing Walmart bingo. Oh, what's Walmart bingo? Well, here, have a card. You can play too. We're giving away a six pack for whoever gets to bingo first. Ah, there it is. God bless you. God bless you, yellow. Went right out and grabbed it. There it is. Yep, sure enough, the Walmart bingo card. You know, print. I'm gonna print up a couple of dozen and just sort of keep them in the family truckster. And after we've gone Krogering, because that's where we do our grocery shopping. Now, I gotta admit, this is frustrating. There's a couple of things that, for the life of me, Kroger doesn't carry, but they're working on it. So, one of them being 100% Colombian decaffeinated coffee. All Kroger carries is that melted brown crayon in hot water decaf.
Blech.
And to be honest, I can't always afford to order the really good stuff. We talked about that a little bit last night. But I avoid Wally World like the plague. But I got to admit, it would be worth walking in just to play a round of, you know, hand a card out to Agnes and a card to Margie and Ferg and Doodle. Take one for myself. Everybody gets one of those little bingo parlor stamping hickeys. And just go wandering separately through Walmart. I guess the three kids would officially have to get unattended. They'd all have to be able to stamp their unattended children thing, because they're children and they'd be unattended. But what a delightfully subversive way of making Walmart have a little hissy. Sir, can I help you? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if you can or not. Let's see. Let me tell you what I'm looking for here. Let's see. I've got rat tail hairstyle. I got a child without shoes. Can you help me find somebody with an eye patch? Or a woman with her hair in curlers? What? Oh, yeah, we're playing Walmart bingo. That's just, print out a couple of dozen. You never know when you're going to have an opportunity to go, and you know, time is the single most finite thing on the planet, especially among human critters. And we have to find a way to get a giggle here and there. What, Lottie, you don't know what a tramp stamp tattoo is? I'm sure somebody in the chat room will elaborate. So that just, I thought that would be a fun thing to start the evening with. A little lightheartedness, if you will. Because it's going to get real weird real fast. I wanted to share something with you this evening. And I had it actually on tap for last night. But we didn't quite get around to it. Something, a bit of a discussion starter. An article by Chris Hedges, who is a brilliantly erudite writer. The title of this one being America the Illiterate. We live in two Americas. One America, now the minority, functions in a print-based literate world. It can cope with complexity and has the intellectual tools to separate illusion from truth. The other America, which constitutes the majority, exists in a non-reality-based belief system. This America, dependent on skillfully manipulated images for information, has severed itself from the literate print-based culture. It cannot differentiate between lies and truth. It is informed by simplistic, childish narratives and cliches. You know, things like pals around with terrorists. That's me editorializing, but back to Chris Hedges. It is thrown into confusion by ambiguity, nuance, and self-reflection. This divide, more than race, class, or gender, more than rural or urban, believer or non-believer, red state or blue state, has split the country into radically distinct, unbridgeable, and antagonistic entities. There are over 42 million American adults, 20% of whom hold high school diplomas. So that would be 8.4 million people have high school diplomas in America who cannot read. Then there's 50 million who read at a fourth or fifth grade level. Nearly a third of the nation's population, 33%, of 300 million. That's 100 million people. Nearly a third of the nation's population is illiterate or barely literate. And their numbers are growing by an estimated 2 million a year. That begins to look like a problem. I don't know about you, but it does to me. But even those who are supposedly literate retreat in huge numbers into this image-based existence. A third of high school graduates, along with 42% of college graduates, never... Wow. Wow. This is horrifying. It's tragic. A third of high school graduates, along with 42% of college graduates, never read a book after they finish school. 80%. You make it all the way through college and you never crack another book? What in heaven's name did you major in? 42% of college graduates never read a book after they finish college? Huh? 80% of the families in the United States last year did not buy a book. That's not 80% of red state families. I imagine that percentage is actually higher. That's not 80% of conservative or Republican families. 80% of the families in the United States last year did not buy a book.
Well, we got a Bible. What else do we need? That's all.
This is cold beads of sweat running down the back of your neck at 3 o'clock in the morning stuff if you actually care about the future of the Republic. The illiterate rarely vote, and when they do vote, they do so without the ability to make decisions based on textual information. American political campaigns, which have learned to speak in the comforting epistemology of images, eschew real ideas and policy for cheap slogans and reassuring personal narratives. That's what we've witnessed in turn.
Well, he was a fighter pilot and he was shot down over Vietnam, so therefore he is by definition more than competent to lead the free world.
Comforting narratives? Yeah. Or how about,
well, he's the kind of guy you could sit down and have a beer with. And that's the kind of man we need for the president. Man we can have beer with. Never mind whether or not he can have a halfway decent conversation with a foreign leader. We want to know if he can throw back a foamer or two right after he gets done cutting the grass and before the wrestling comes on.
That engaging narrative line, though, sort of jumped out at me because, I read several different things at one time, and apparently I'm in the minority for doing it. But just to revisit that line... American political campaigns, which have learned to speak in the comforting epistemology of images, eschew real ideas and policy for cheap slogans and reassuring personal narratives. Political propaganda now masquerades as ideology. Political campaigns have become an experience. They do not require cognitive or self-critical skills. They are designed to ignite pseudo-religious feelings of euphoria, empowerment, and collective salvation. Now, hold on there for a minute. Like I said, I read several things at one time. And I read an interview over at Salon a little less than a month ago in advance of the final panels of Berkeley Breathed's Opus strip. And that strip closed on November the 2nd, and it was charming. But he did an interview with Salon in which he... gave a little bit of the insight behind why it was he was shutting down and where it is that he thinks America is going. And there was a question put to Berkeley Breathitt in which he said, your children's books seem to appeal to your gentler Charles Schulz side, but how, without Opus, will you exercise your Michael Moore side? Berkeley Breathitt responded, I'll be on my couch Sunday mornings screaming at Brokaw and Stephanopoulos to call out the blathering bastards on their stupid fucking talking points and pin the dancing, lying, spinning Tasmanian weasels down about something, anything, for Christ's bloody sake. The country is getting steered into chaos and insolvency and war by its unread, uninformed, dullard sheep constituencies, and you just let the candidate say one more time without objection that he's going to cut taxes while he calls for free 24-karat gold frankfurters to be inserted into every American's ass just because butt bullion polls well. I love it when I see different methods of saying roughly the same thing. And those two that I read earlier today just leaped out at me. On the one hand, you have Chris Hedges, who in didactic, scholarly, polysyllabic form says that American politics have learned to speak in the comforting epistemology of images, eschew real ideas and policy for cheap slogans and reassuring personal narratives. Political propaganda now masquerades as ideology, and political campaigns have become an experience. They do not require cognitive or self-critical skills. They are designed to ignite pseudo-religious feelings of euphoria, empowerment, and collective salvation. Campaigns that succeed are carefully constructed psychological instruments that manipulate fickle public moods, emotions, and impulses, many of which are subliminal. They create a public ecstasy that annuls individuality and fosters a state of mindlessness. They thrust us into an eternal present. They cater to a nation that now lives in a state of permanent amnesia. It is style and story, not content or history or reality, which inform our politics and our lives. We prefer happy illusions. And it works because so much of the American electorate, including those who should know better, blindly cast ballots for slogans, smiles, the cheerful family tableau, narratives, and the perceived sincerity and the attractiveness of candidates. We confuse how we feel with knowledge. Holy cats. What have we been saying for years? We confuse how we feel with knowledge. What have we been saying for years? What have I been saying? Not me and that mouse in my pocket. What have I been saying? Believe is the single most hateful word in the English language, because out of believe, yeah, you can get the word evil. In fact, just a little anagram on the fly, or at least a partial one, you can get be evil out of believe. Can't you? Yeah, you can. So with all those lovely, lovely scholarly words, you can turn around and Berkeley Breathitt can boil it down to the fact that our for-profit-only media lets politicians get away with letting candidates say one more time without objection that he's going to cut taxes while he calls for free 24-karat gold frankfurters to be inserted into every American's ass just because butt bullion polls well. And ain't it the truth? Ain't it just the truth? Of course, saying ain't it the truth is probably not the best way to point out the veracity of an article about literacy. Now, Chris Hedges continues, and he says, the illiterate and semi-literate, once the campaigns are over, remain powerless. They still cannot protect their children from dysfunctional public schools. They still cannot understand predatory loan deals, the intricacies of mortgage papers, credit card agreements and equity lines of credit that drive them into foreclosures and bankruptcies. They still struggle with the most basic chores of daily life, from reading instructions on medicine bottles to filling out bank forms, car loan documents, and unemployment benefit and insurance papers. They watch helplessly and without comprehension as hundreds of thousands of jobs are shed. They're hostages to brands. Brands come with images and slogans. Images and slogans are all they understand. Many eat at fast food restaurants not only because it is cheap, but because they can order from pictures rather than menus. I have a sneaking suspicion that Chris Hedges has seen Idiocracy. And those who serve them, also semi-literate or illiterate, punch in orders on cash registers whose keys are marked with symbols and pictures. This is our brave new world. Tell me this guy's wrong. He's not. Now, I'm sure Repiglicans would holler, elitist. Why, yes, yes, Repiglicans would holler, elitist. I have the proof right here. The brother of the oxymoron, the brother of that street drug junkie, Rush Limbaugh, David Limbaugh. Democrats bashing Palin, Southerners. Here we go again. Nothing's going to get any better. He said, Southern counties voting more Republican this year, quoting an individual by Adam Nossiter of the New York Times. Southern counties voting more Republican this year, he said, tended to be poorer, less educated, and whiter, as they have been rural and isolated and less exposed to diversity, educational achievement, and economic progress. According to the omniscient Nossiter, Mr. Obama's race appears to have been the critical deciding factor in pushing even greater numbers of white Southerners away from the Democrats. You see, and I don't know that we've talked about this, I don't know why anybody would be surprised to hear this, but it hasn't much been mentioned. Barack Obama lost Alabama worse than John Kerry did. John McCain carried Alabama stronger than George Bush did in 2004 or 2001. Nossiter cited one political analyst, says Limbaugh, saying, there's no other explanation than race for Obama receiving a smaller percentage of the Alabama vote, Alabama white vote, than John Kerry did in 2004. Oh, says Limbaugh, how about reasonable anxiety about Obama's alliances and gaps in his biography, not to mention that he made the mistake of revealing his socialism and contempt for rural Bible and gun-toting Americans when away from his teleprompters. One might think the liberals' persistent demagoguery on race, mostly for partisan gain, would subside with the election of Barack Obama, but one would be wrong. Prescient commentators predicted that if Obama won, there would be no letting up. They speculated that charges of racism might even escalate as an emboldened left would begin an all-out war against conservative talk radio. Lo and behold, before the Electoral College has even convened to formalize Obama's victory, the slanderous group emails have begun. I personally received a number of them today, one of which said conservative talk radio is all hate all the time, racist, homophobic, sexist. Don't think they aren't methodically laying a foundation to strip conservative America of its most powerful First Amendment outlet, talk radio, so they can restore their coveted liberal media monopoly. Oh, yeah. He says, God bless Sarah Palin, and shame on elitists from both sides of the aisle who have denigrated, demonized, and dissed her. I don't care how many smartest people in the room types offer pseudo-sophisticated analyses to prove she was a drag on the GOP presidential ticket. In other words, what Limbaugh says is he doesn't care how much factual evidence is presented. He lives in belief world. And he's going to do all his believing and none of his thinking. They are all manifestly and embarrassingly wrong and woefully out of touch, which is par for the course for, say it with me, friends and neighbors, elitists. Speaking of elitists, it's time to address their contempt for rural and southern America, particularly their ongoing smear of the South, and truth be told, rank-and-file conservative Republicans as racist. Oh, he writes Republicans, my bad, as racist. Well, hell, David Limbaugh, it wasn't a couple of kumbaya singing liberals that were plotting to blow away an African-American school and kill 88 and behead 14 and then go out in a blaze of glory shooting it out with the federales trying to get to Obama while they wore top hats and tails. Now, was it, Dave? No. It wasn't in Albany, New York, that a man was selling Curious George Obama T-shirts and proud of it. Now, was it David Obama? And I do believe it was in Bonner County, Idaho, where a man has a handmade cardboard sign featuring a noose that he's made out of nylon rope. And it says, "Free public hangings. Read Pelosi, Obama." And the man probably could not elaborate on one single of the issue espoused by any one of the three. But it's elitist to point out their ignorance and their pitiable stupidity. The sad thing, however, is that the right wing takes this stupidity and uses it for its brutish ends to make cultural shock troops of such people. But you see, the thing is, Chris Hedges is pointing out something about 80% of American families and 42% of college graduates. About 42 million adults, and he says neither right wing nor left. He goes on and says, "Political leaders in our post-literate society no longer need to be competent, sincere, or honest." The fact that we have a phrase out there like post-literate is horrifying. It means, I mean, now, you know, you've seen in the last couple of weeks the word post-partisan used as meaning that we've gotten beyond the era of right-wing repiglic and filth and hate. Post-literate? What comes after being literate? It's not, no, I don't think there's any such thing as post-literate. There's literate and illiterate. And there's, I guess, deliterate. Maybe what he's looking for is deliterate. And I'm not being critical of Chris Hedges. He's a brilliant writer. "Political leaders in our post-literate society no longer need to be competent, sincere, or honest. They only need to appear to have these qualities. Most of all, they need a story, a narrative. The reality of the narrative is irrelevant. It can be completely at odds with the facts. The consistency and emotional appeal of the story are paramount. The most essential skill in political theater and the consumer culture is artifice. Those who are best at artifice succeed. Those who have not mastered the art of artifice fail. In an age of images and entertainment, in an age of instant emotional gratification, we do not seek or want honesty. We ask to be indulged and entertained by cliches, stereotypes, and mythic narratives that tell us we can be whomever we want to be, that we live in the greatest country on earth, that we are endowed with superior moral and physical qualities, and that our glorious future is preordained, either because of our attributes as Americans or because we are blessed by God and or both. The ability to magnify these simple and childish lies, to repeat them and have surrogates repeat them in endless loops of news cycles, gives these lies the aura of an uncontested truth. We are repeatedly fed words or phrases like, yes, we can, maverick, change, pro-life, hope, or war on terror. It feels good not to think. All we have to do is visualize what we want, believe in ourselves, believe, believe, believe. Oh, believe in Tinkerbell and she will not die. Oh, believe, everybody. Oh, please, Tinkerbell is dying. It feels good not to think. All we have to do is visualize what we want, believe in ourselves, and summon those hidden inner resources, whether divine or national, that make the world conform to our desires. Reality is never an impediment to our advancement. Kate says, this is a... Bob. This is a visual electronic culture. Literacy has fallen by the way. Folks rely on symbols and verbal shorthand. In the future, the past will overtake us where art and pictographs were the major form of visual communication. That and voice and music. Welcome to the approach of the ancient. And, of course, in that ancient world, literacy was a secret kept by the... Yes, the elite. See, that's what makes the Greek alphabet, for instance, such a quantum leap forward. A young man, and yeah, sorry, I'm not trying to be sexist, it was the nature of the culture. A young man learning to be a scribe in ancient Egypt was truly an indispensable individual, and hence they held lofty position. Because they spent literally years upon years upon years learning all the pictographs, all the hieroglyphs, and all the permutations upon them so as to be able to make some sort of sense out of not only what they were going to try to write in their own careers, but what had been written before. And then, bang, you get the Greek alphabet. Which, of course, they lifted from the Phoenicians. And suddenly, instead of pictures representing words, you had letters representing sounds. And while literacy didn't just explode and everyone suddenly become literate, it expanded with incredible breadth as compared to the elites who were the only ones who knew how to read the funny little squiggly pictures on the Egyptian cartouches. It is a visual electronic culture. It's one of those things that, as someone who is fascinated with cultures and fascinated with the viability of cultures, that I think about frequently. We know what ancient Egyptian culture was like because their medium of recording their thoughts, for our purposes, was stone. And some papyri still survive. We know some about ancient Greek culture because they carved a lot in stone, because they wrote on wet clay. Up until we invaded Iraq and destroyed that ancient culture, there were rows upon rows and shelves upon shelves in antiquities museums in Iraq that had fragile, dusty clay tablets on it that were the earliest manifestations of the yearnings of humanity to record its existence for posterity. Oh, sure, there are earlier manifestations. There are the paintings rubbed with ochre onto cave walls in France and Spain with a finger or a thumb. There are handprints, but we have no way of knowing what the handprints meant. And whether the picture of the horse meant, I want a horse, I worship a horse, I eat a horse, we don't know. But it would appear, either consciously or unconsciously, we are pre-selecting for an illiterate culture. And that is not to say that illiterate cultures have no worth. They have profound worth. There was Homer before there was literacy. The Epic of Gilgamesh was told around fires before ever it was recorded in the series of little triangular incisions of a reed into a wet clay tablet that became cuneiform. Illiterate cultures have profound memories. It's reminiscent of the culture that Ray Bradbury describes in Fahrenheit 451, in which one person will be, say, Shakespeare's Hamlet, and commit a life to remembering Shakespeare's Hamlet and passing it on to someone else who's willing to be Shakespeare's Hamlet, because there are no books. But I look at words in a chat room, or words on a web page, or words in an email, and it's so stunningly unreal. And I realize that I can imagine. I'm a weirdo. I've walked around in fields at groundbreaking plowing time in the South, big flat fields that'll later be corn or soybeans or cotton. And you just can't help it. You just walk along, and every now and then you go, I'll be damned. And you reach down and you pick up an arrowhead, or what is more properly termed a point. And you realize that in order for the white man's truth about North America, in other words, a vast, uninhabited natural wonderland waiting to be conquered by white folk, in order for that to be true, those points can't be there, because those points are tangible, and those points are 2, 4, 3, 5, 8,000, 10,000 years old. And there had to be people all over this place for them to be so broadly dispersed with such frequency. And that is all that is left of them. And I fear that we are setting our culture up for something similar. I mean, you realize that in the 21st century, we don't know that much about 11th century Europe. We're hard-pressed to recreate their world. The Bible recounts stories, for instance, from 700, 800 B.C., of the prophet Samuel and David and Solomon, those folks, and a lot of slewing and smiting going on, and begotten and behaving. The Celtic culture that spread from the steppes of Russia all the way across to the islands of Britain and Ireland was far more cohesive, far more advanced. They were not, however, literate. And all we have, as far as knowing what they were like, is what little archaeological record we have, and the impressions of the people who destroyed their culture, to wit, for the most part, the Romans. And that's sad, because to one degree or another, those are my people. And I would like to know a little bit more about them, beside the fact that every now and then they grab some rotten luck Willie, put a leather cap on his head, garroted him with a leather cord, and threw him in a peat bog to appease some stupid god. But that's the picture we get, even though there are brilliant artifacts that show what amazing metal workers they were, and that they had vast and extensive trade networks. It's very similar to what we do know about North American cultures, because you can go on a dig in Tennessee and dig up a shell bead breastplate or a necklace or some such, or even a mirror that came from the shores of Lake Erie, and you go, holy cow, how did that happen? And you wish they could have left us something to tell us a little bit about what they knew, about what they learned, about what their wisdom was. But they did not. They practiced the approach of the ancient. And all of this electronic learning is ever so fragile and can be disappeared with the push of a button. The Bush administration showed us that with their damned email controversy. Knowledge being the most fragile of all possessions. And it scares me. It does. It truly does. So maybe that's a little something to think about as we go into the evening. Let's go to the phones.
Bob?
Yeah, hey.
Let's see. What are we going to talk about tonight? Anything good? Earlier, I was listening to Mark when he was talking about, you know, us having to reach out to the Republicans.
Yeah.
So, you know, talking about, and I'm sitting here and I'm just had that, hear that voice in my mind saying the same thing in the mid-90s. We have to reach out to these Republicans, and every time we did, we got our teeth kicked in.
Yeah, you reach out with the olive branch and you draw back a bloody stump.
Well, you know, we were talking, you know, they've been talking all this stuff with Palin and stuff, and some people laughing about it. You remember this because you were, I think, in the area at the time. Just remember, in the mid-80s, we laughed at some fellow named Newt Gingrich.
I used to laugh at him routinely.
Because he used to, you know, do the midnight speeches on C-SPAN, and everybody thought, what's he doing? And 5 years later, he's running the House of Representatives.
Yeah, and he came from Gwinnett County, Georgia, which was a northern suburb of Atlanta, and we used mm-hmm. to just, what's the matter with those people?
Because back then we all thought he was just nuttier than a fruitcake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but the thing with Palin, it's turning interesting now which way this is going to go with her versus the other governors. That was just a fun little press conference.
Yeah, they weren't real crazy about her today.
I was just sitting there watching, going, which one of them is going to take out his pocket watch and take the watch chain and just go up there and just garrote her.
Well,
because every once in a while they show the other's faces. Charlie Crist did not look like a happy camper.
Charlie Crist wanted to get away from her as fast as he humanly possibly could.
It's just interesting.
She had a case of contagious, galloping political pneumonia.
What, you know, I got thinking, you know what the weirdest thing all comes out of all this, I think, of this week, of their conference? You know who essentially I think leaves in charge of the GOP right now? Haley Barbour.
Well, that's pretty sick.
I know, that's what I mean. But if I had to pick who I think right now is probably, maybe, you know, he won't run for anything, but you know what I mean? But who I think right now is coming out of the GOP sort of as the leader, per se, behind the power, should we call it, is going to end up being him. But, now the thing they're pushing tonight is everybody's going, will Hillary be our next Secretary of State? And I'm just sitting there going, don't do it. If you're offered the job, say no. Because, you know good and well, the minute she takes that job, any decision she makes, they're going to be on the TV going, was she making this decision to stick the knife in Barack's back? You know, anything she does, they're going to second, triple guess it.
Sure.
I mean, they're going to write it up one side and down the other. It's like, please pick Bill Richardson. You know, somebody, you know, that's who I'm hoping he picks. But you know what I mean? It's one of those things. It's like,
What's this line I heard from Obama about he's going to be Lincoln-esque in his cabinet choices and pick his opponents?
Behind the Lincoln assassination with some of his cabinet?
See, that's the thing. Yeah, you're right. It's true.
Wasn't the guy, was it George?
Seward. It was Seward.
They thought he was the one behind the whole thing?
Or was it Stinson?
Okay, but I remember it was one of his members of his cabinet, because he had one of those cabinets where he opened people from all sides.
Yeah,
and amazingly enough, the people he put in charge just did everything they could to get rid of him.
But, I understand. Yeah, it's okay if you want to have a Republican in there, but let's not go overboard.
No, I mean, if you want to put Chuck Hagel at defense, fine. I can live with that. You know what I mean? You know, there's if you get Jim Leach or somebody like that. But even though Jim Leach has got a lot of baggage. Because he's one of the big deregulators. But you know what I mean? But one thing I wanted to mention before I forgot, tonight is Bill Maher's season ender.
Oh, so So tomorrow morning it ends at midnight, right?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll go to that website and watch the
online chat?
Yeah, the extra part.
Yeah. But, it's just been interesting to watch this. I mean, they're just sitting there, like I said, right now I've got MSNBC on carrying their 1600. show, and the chyron on the bottom is Obama, team of rivals.
Oh, God.
See, I mean, they're already setting it up. But, you know, it's just...
I know.
Oh, there's that thing I saw today. Was it the new Baba Wawa special?
Oh, really?
Did you see who she's picking her fascinating people of the year?
No.
Every one of them she picked was...
Oh, do tell.
The pig man.
And Mr. Wimbaugh, what kind of twee would you be if you were a twee, Mr. Wimbaugh?
And I'm sitting there going, look, if you're going to pick somebody in the media who hit their year this year, you'd pick Oberman.
Sure you would.
You know?
But ABC, ABC's owned by the rat.
Yeah, that's true.
And
ABC also is connected to Limbaugh's organization.
I do believe, yeah. But the fact of the matter is, if he's one of this year's most fascinating people,
she must not get out much.
She must not get out much because, among other things, his audience is stagnating.
Oh, yeah.
It hasn't grown for years, has it?
No, but you know how that works. I mean,
it's that same 3 million people every day.
It just counts them each hour as another 3 million.
Mm-hmm.
And then they used to do things like, I know one time they talked about it, that he had a whole bunch of people. One of the things they caught one or two of their guys doing was it would have the radio on in the service station, and it would count all the people that came through the service station.
Yeah.
How big an audience you got? Oh, we got 200-300 people.
Oh, it's a delightful racket that he runs. And he's done. Well, he wasn't. No, like I said on the Wednesday after the election, Luke, he's the happiest man in America right now.
Oh, yeah. The only thing I enjoyed, like I say, was just that the night after when Oberman went on and he did his worst persons of the world. He picked Limbaugh for, like, second place, and he said, Rush Limbaugh said, doesn't matter. Threw it away. You know, so for a little while, he don't matter. Because, like you say, we know what he's going to do. Anything he's going to be out there. Like I say, they're already whipping up, you know, they should impeach him. And it's already the Obama recession. It's like, wait a minute. He don't get to take power for 10 weeks. How is it his recession?
Exactly. But there's, you know, there's that old junkie pushing it right along. My friends, this is the Obama recession. Now, bear in mind, the economy started tanking the minute that George Bush was elected, but that was Bill Clinton's recession. Remember that?
And most people forget the other thing was, you know, that during the last election and this election, every time you turn around, you had Greenspan lowering the interest rates. In 2000, he refused to because, as he said, he didn't want to influence the elections.
Yeah.
And as you were talking about earlier on the thing about, you know, wanting to have somebody you can go have a drink with, I tell most people this, when you're out drinking, take a look around that bar. There ain't many people there you'd want running the country, you know.
Like, or if you do think they would be good running the country, odds are that you're already half in the bag.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things. And the thing was, in 2000, let's see, who do you get? Well, let's see. We can either get a guy who we know is a reformed drunk, and we also think is maybe a reformed addict. Other guy, well, let's see, he's a wonk who probably will stay up to 1 or 2 in the morning each morning working on it. Oh, dear Lord, let's pick the drunk. Come on. Because you know good well that's what they did in 2000. Anything that George is because he was a regular kind of guy.
Well, see, that's the myth, though. That's the myth I think that Chris Hedges was talking about that is created, that an idiot can run this.
Oh.
That it, you know, that this nation is... Well, you know, the framers spoke in plain language, and we need to stick to the plain language of the Constitution. It's that stupid letter from Chuck Norris I read on the air last night.
Oh, God.
Somebody's
wearing the tap shoes and have been hitting him in the head again, have they?
Jesus. Chuck Norris, please. But this idea that the framers were just a bunch of good old boys who sat down and wrote a little pamphlet that would be handy to have if you were going to set up a government. Dadgummit, Ben Franklin was, at the time, the single most intelligent man that this continent had ever produced.
And Thomas Jefferson was standing in line right behind him.
Right, and those two still rank in the top 10.
And even though he probably was the first real conservative, I'll give Adams credit. He knew what he was doing. He wasn't no dummy.
No. He did feel as if the biography and stuff is to be believed, he felt a little bit inferior in Jefferson and Franklin's presence. But no,
who would?
But Madison was a genius. Hell, he was an evil genius. But Hamilton was a genius.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I say when you go down the list, I mean all of them. I mean, you know, a lot of them were just businessmen from the, you know, but still, they knew that what they were doing wasn't for them as much as it was for everybody.
And if they have a fault, Luke, it is the assumption that they made that there would always be persons of genius involved in running the government.
Yeah.
And the way they set up the electoral system, I suppose that they thought they had ensured it. You know, the only thing that could, only people who could be directly elected were, as far as the federal government was concerned, was the House of Representatives. The state legislatures would elect the senators, and the Electoral College would elect the presidents.
Well, thereby keeping
the government out of the hands of morons.
Whoops. Well, there that went.
Yeah. No, it was.
We've had 8 years of that being proved wrong.
But it all, but that's all stuff that got changed later. I think the first most fundamental change that struck this nation was the decision to shift away from having the guy who comes in second be vice president.
Yeah.
And
they did the one, you know, where they had the senators were no longer appointed.
Right. But as much of a pain in the butt as Jefferson was to Adams, and as much of a pain in the butt as Burr was to Jefferson, I can't help thinking that maybe those guys were right. That there's supposed to be some dynamic tension. I used the word jealousy last night in a conversation to describe the system of checks and balances. Jealousy of powers granted under the Constitution and jealous guarding of them. You know, in many ways, if you look at the federal government as it's set out under the Constitution, it's not designed to work smoothly. It's designed to work hesitantly.
Yeah. We don't want, you know, we want them to every once in a while make a good decision that's sort of provisionally thinking. You know what I mean? Think ahead. But at the same time, you can't think too far ahead because the world changes too often.
Well, it changes constantly.
Yeah. I mean, you can plan a little bit ahead, but some of these people who are trying to plan for 20 years ahead, it's like, no, it ain't going to be the same in 4 years, much less 20 years. When I hear them do some of these plots where, yeah, we're going to have this work out in 20 years, it's like, gee, have you got the crystal ball? What's going to happen for that next, you know, to the Dow for the next 20 years? If you can tell me that, then you can make those kind of plans. But, you know, anything more than 3 or 4 years, you don't need to be making plans like that.
You don't need to be hanging debt around a generation unborn.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's what we have now, and it certainly look how it's working out.
I know, but like I say, what we started with, I just like say, please let him offer the job to Hillary, and let Hillary say, no, I'd rather work it through the Senate. Because like I say, A, I think she can do better there, and B, if she takes the job, It's going to be second and third guessing from day one, before day one.
Well, see, there's two or three chess moves behind that, though.
Oh, yeah.
There's the question of who fills her Senate seat.
Yep.
If
that's a lot of different people have to make these kind of questions. Like, if you pick Kerry, who's going to fill Kerry's seat?
Yeah.
You know, there's every time you make one of these decisions, you've got to think it's a domino. It doesn't affect just one move. It affects two or three moves down the road.
And you've also got to remember that, well, I mean, like, you know, bringing somebody out of the governorship, you got to remember that one of the things that Mussolini said the other day was that she wanted Republican governors to stand as a bulwark against the Obama administration. Well, you know, I don't care if you're a Republican governor or a Democrat governor. Either way, you have seen your state pauperized through the last 8 years, thanks largely to the Bush tax cuts.
Yep.
And even Mitch Daniels in Indiana, even he broke ranks with his former master, George Bush, when he saw what was happening to the state budget there.
Well, like I say, one of the big things that's going to be, I think, of this, that's going to be one of Obama's legacies, I hope, is going to have to be infrastructure repair. Because we're at the point now where we've got to start making some repairs.
Oh, yeah, we do.
We're going to start falling apart faster and faster.
And we're also going to have to, I mean, look at the unemployment numbers.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to put some people to work. Just last week when we were shooting video here, we went down to a little state park about 2 miles from where I live. And I showed it, and there's all this beautiful stonework construction, walls, buildings, and, you know, rough-hewn timbers in between. And it's classic CCCWPA construction, you know, the Works Progress Administration and the Civilian Conservation Corps. And we're gonna have to have something like that.
Oh yeah, but you know, I mean, like the thing up in Minnesota, you know, where had a bridge collapse. Unfortunately, that's gonna happen more often if they don't start doing some stuff.
Sure it is.
I mean, right now they're just barely doing enough to keep everything running. I mean, because there's a lot of these bridges that they need to, you know, close them down, rebuild them, or refurbish, however, you know, whatever the state of the places are. And if they don't do it soon, like I say, it's going to get to the point where it's like, well, we can't fix it. We have to build a new one. You know, where maybe it would have cost $10 million to repair it. It's going to take us $30 million. Now we have to build a new one.
And, of course,
the old one we can't use.
And the other thing that I'm no longer willing to accept is this rubric of, well, we can't afford it. I don't ever want to hear a Republican tell me what we can and cannot afford ever again.
Like,
because every time they've wanted it,
for 10 years.
Yeah, every time they've wanted it, they've just turned on the money presses and made more.
I know.
Or hung some more bad paper on China.
True enough.
You know, we didn't have any. We couldn't afford health care. I mean, you know, the right wing had a fit. Remember what was it, Harry and Louise?
Oh yeah.
They were having a fit back in the 90s when we were talking about some level of health care for all America. Oh, we can't afford it. We can't afford it. We can't afford it.
And the thing is, if they ever would go through and put in some form of universal coverage, there's so many places that are suffering, you know, in businesses where small businesses are suffering because they have to keep up insurance, that would just go away. In that respect, you know what I mean? It will still be a problem, but not as big a problem as it has been.
Well, you know, two things. The Employees Free Choice Act.
Yes.
That will bring unions to shops that, by card check agreement, say that they want to organize.
What do you bet that'll be the first filibuster?
It'll be an early one because Obama has to come through on his promise on it. And, you know, the Democrats already showed Reid and Pelosi their willingness to put it through. But Reid didn't have the guts to, or maybe even the numbers, to be fair, to make any kind of a credible threat against the Republicans for killing it under George Bush. George Bush, of course, was ready to veto it. So, you know, there's that. This time through, however, I want to hear talk about that nuclear option.
And like I say, when they filibuster, I want them over there talking to some of these, you know, the Republicans on the edge, because I think they're gonna pull a few. You know, you're going to pull Olympia Snow, or you're going to pull another lady up in New England. You know, you got two or three on there that are probably going to vote with you on certain things like that. So
maybe
So you may lose one or two, but the thing is, you may lose one or two Democrats along the way.
Ben Nelson.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And there, you know, one of the things I don't understand on employee free choice, Luke,
mm-hmm.
is the Republicans are fond of touting this quote from George McGovern saying it's a bad idea.
What did they crop off of it?
I don't know. I mean, I can't sort it because it takes away the secret ballot. When it doesn't take away the secret ballot.
But I bet you tend to wonder there's something a lot more to that statement that they've cropped off of it. But he probably was talking about some little part of it that he didn't like, and they probably cropped it off to say he hates the whole damn thing.
That would be about par for the course. Yeah,
that's going to say that's what most of it is. I tell you what, Bud, it's top of the hour. Let me let you get on.
All right, you take care, Luke, and have a great weekend. Sorry about Wyoming last week, man.
Yeah, life is like that.
Yeah, I know.
All righty, have a good weekend. Right. Bye.
Later. Bye. Yeah, while Luke was feeling miserable over the University of Wyoming beating Tennessee, I was watching West Virginia's hopes of winning the Big East go down the swirler by mailing it in at Cincinnati. Or with Cincinnati, at home. That made it worse. So, yeah, into each life some rain must fall. Let's keep rolling on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, this is Juanita.
Hey, Juanita.
I wanted to tell you the latest count.
Okay.
8,448,416.
That's butt whipping.
Yep.
As margins
and
go.
They're still counting.
Yes, they are. And
yep.
You know what? Not there in Georgia. Did you? I know you're a big C-SPAN watcher. Did you notice?
Not as much as I used to be since y'all are on.
Well, true. Yeah. And we're grateful that you've chosen us over C-SPAN. Trust me.
Hey, you give me a reason to live sometime, I'll tell you.
But I just happened to be flipping around. We've got an odd circumstance going on here insofar as our eldest daughter and her husband and the two babies are off visiting his people. So we don't have a house full of babies, so we got ours down to sleep, and Agnes and I were just sitting there watching television last night. It was really, really weird. We sort of kept looking around, and then we'd look at each other, and what the heck is wrong here? But clicking around, and I hit C-SPAN, and there, lo and behold, is old Lumpy McHoover, John McCain, down there stumping his butt off for Saxby Chambliss.
Oh, yeah. The first time I had heard that Sarah was going to go there, too, but I don't know if they forbade her.
Well, I don't know. I guess I need to see, or somebody needs to find, what
yeah.
the margin of victory was in Georgia. I didn't think it was that broad. But we've got to, you know, we got to get some of our own down there, because that's a whole brand new race.
I understand that. Obama was sending people down there to go into the different communities and all.
It might be a good idea for him to get himself down there.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, Chambliss said our kind of people didn't get it, come out and vote enough or something like that.
And this is another, you know, this is another chance to get out the vote.
Yeah. You want to hear Chuck Norris' story?
Oh, do please.
you know, from time to time I've listened to Alex Jones. I had to quit for a while.
I know, yeah.
But anyway, one day he was talking about, I mean, he's had Jesse Ventura on a lot, and he was saying, somebody really famous is coming on, and I'm not going to tell you who it is. It's going to be a surprise. And it was Chuck Norris. He's written a new book or something, and he was talking his new book. And, of course, Alex is thrilled to death, and anyway, he said, he told Alex, he said, oh, I listen to your program almost every day. I've listened to it a long, long time. And, you know, for years. And anyway, he would ask him, what did he think about such and such? If you're a listener to his show, even like I do, you're going to know that what most of his talking points are, you know, the more of a compliment.
Sure, sure,
you know.
Yeah.
And he'd say, no. My son was over here, and I said, that guy's lying. He don't listen to him. You know, it's just everything, but Alex was so thrilled with him being there till he didn't get it.
Oh.
But he was saying, I understand you're going to support, who's the one that's supporting Ron down there? In Texas.
Oh, Paul?
Who?
Ron Paul?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that his name? Yeah.
Yeah.
And he
wacky
said,
little
yeah.
racist
then,
libertarian. Yeah.
It was like he thought that Chuck Norris had gone over to their side because they say they don't like either party now.
Right.
But anyway, before Chuck Norris got off, he said something about the preacher guy that he had.
Oh, Mike Huckabee. Yeah, Huckabee. Yeah.
But I told my son said he just wanted to sell a book. You know,
he's hustling. He's hustling a book, sure.
Yeah, and so he's so phony. You know, he's just a phony baloney.
Yeah, that letter last night just made me sick.
Yeah, that was something.
Yeah, because he's just the guy.
We'll be watching you.
We'll be watching you, or I'll kick your face in.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so tough.
Well, him and Ted Nugent, they're cut out of the same mold.
Yeah. Well, you know, I say Ted Nugent's a little bit more of a man of his word, you know, for some of the things, but Chuck Norris.
Kind of depends on how you define that, Juanita. I mean,
I'm not trying
to be gross or anything, but we are in Ted Nugent talking about a man who didn't change his clothes for a couple of weeks and soiled himself and everything to get out of, you know, going to Vietnam. I guess that's what.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Oh yeah, I guess that's what you do if you're a right winger and you don't have a bush for a daddy, and you really, really don't want to go. It's, you know, that.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's like this. He hunts with arrows and he kills what he kills. He eats what he kills. You know, stuff like that. I don't admire him at all.
No, but then he stands on a stage and holds up a machine gun and tells Hillary Clinton to suck on it.
Yeah.
You know.
Well,
nice.
Yeah, I take back what I said.
Well, no, I'm not castigating you, but no, he's just a miserable right wing piece of garbage, and I fully expect him to be president of the National Rifle Association before too very much longer.
Yeah.
You know, in that Charlton Heston role, holding up the musket, they can have my gun when they pry it from my cold dead fingers.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember watching him in, I think it was Fahrenheit, the Michael Morse movie.
Oh no, that was Bowling for Columbine. Yeah.
Bowling for, when he went to his house.
Right.
And he was welcoming in, and then he got to talking, and he didn't know what to make of it.
Yeah, and everybody said Michael Moore abused poor Charlton Heston.
Yeah. And I was glad to find out how what a twerp Dick Clark is.
Oh, really?
You didn't see that part of it?
I don't remember, no.
Oh. Do you remember when a woman, her son got killed or got in trouble? I don't know if he killed somebody, but she was on welfare and... It's when they had to go to work, and she had to catch a bus that take them, you know, way off to work. Well, you know who the boss was?
Dick Clark. Yeah.
And he was, and he didn't like it a bit because Moore asked him about it.
Well, none of these people like it when they get caught. That's why.
But he's got slave labor pretty much.
Well, but look at how the pharmaceutical industry responded to Sicko, threatening their own employees. Don't you dare talk to Michael Moore. And we'll see it again because I read a report just the other day that Michael Moore is working feverishly to finish, hopefully by, I think, a spring release, finish a documentary on the economy. And you'll see people running the other way from that, too.
I see. He's one of my heroes. You know, a lot of people don't like him, and a lot of people are taught against him, you know, like he's worse than the Antichrist.
Oh, yeah. And no matter how true it is, whatever it is that he puts out there, oh, yeah, he's a propagandist. He's not a word of truth in him.
Yeah, like that Bullet for Columbine. It was mostly stuff I had seen before on the news, our news, you know.
Yeah.
You know, not the real news that's supposed to be on our side, you know. I don't even watch that anymore. Like those, you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
ABC and NBC and all like that. Oh, and I heard, what's his name talking about? Baba?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that. I hadn't heard that about her saying him. Maybe she'll explain on the show.
Well, she's really slipped if she thinks.
I know. it. What has he done this year?
I guess it's for his Operation Chaos. Yeah, that worked real well.
What was that now?
Operation Chaos. Remember, he was going to stop Obama by having Republicans go to the polls and vote for Hillary in the primaries?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, nice.
Well, I guess that backfired on him.
Yeah, it didn't work so good.
And I have a question I want to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
You said, I don't know if it's actually two words or one word, you said a word day before yesterday that I thought my daddy had made up. Because
oh, dear.
But I guess not. Puzzle gut.
Oh, yeah. Puzzle gutted. No, that's an oldie but a goodie.
Yeah, my daddy used to use it, like, for cuss words.
Sure.
And Pender.
Mm-hmm.
Pender puzzle gut Farnsworth. But when you said that, I never heard anybody else say it. I thought he'd made it up because he was inclined that way.
That the puzzle gut and lick spittle, you know, it's all part of the music of Southern American English.
Well, I looked at there's some things about it online too because I looked it up after you said that and I thought I got to ask him about that. But so you think it came from the South?
Oh, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
You think it's in the dictionary?
Oh, probably of some form, yeah.
But I won't get back to your subject. I'll just say one little thing about it.
Okay.
I'm sure you have, but have you ever studied any of the cannibalistic people?
Well, to a certain, yeah, somewhat.
Well, when I was growing up and all, I was just shivered and shook, you know. I was so afraid of them. But I started, I don't know if I saw a documentary or what, but then I started reading about them. And a lot of them are very honorable. They do that for very honorable reasons.
Very specific reasons, too.
Yeah. And if their mother and daddy are real sick, they'll ask a neighbor, some of them, you know, to go over and kill them, you know, hit them up on the back of the head. And that's a great honor.
Yeah. Well, you know, cultures are relative. There are things that some cultures do that we don't, or that we do that they don't, that are based on the things that are forced on them by their environment, especially primitive cultures.
Yeah.
There was a degree of cannibalism in the ancient Central Mexican cultures, but it wasn't a matter of them sitting around and just, you know, gnawing on each other.
No.
There was human sacrifice, and for instance, if you captured the warrior who was sacrificed, after he was sacrificed, you ate a little bit of his thigh.
His thigh?
Yeah, you know, ham.
Oh.
And you did so to get his warriorly prowess.
Yeah.
So.
And some of the Eskimos, you know, they would, when they got older, they'd go out on ice floats.
Yeah, just
and,
sail away.
And then they would, the polar bears would, you know, kill them and eat them. And then instead of them, the Eskimos actually eating their family the first time, it was passed through the polar bears, and they thought that was a great honor.
And you know, you come up with the people's come up with these terms, like the terms of honor, as a means of dealing with the practical realities of their world.
Yeah maybe it's, I don't know, but you know, I think most people are alike in a lot of ways, but it's the culture.
Well, we're all human at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. And I like that. I like the different cultures. I like to learn about them. You know, people that I meet and all, you know, from different. We have a lot of them down here from different countries.
Sure.
Doctors and so forth. And I don't know why some people are so upset about the Muslims, when a lot of the doctors that we have down here are Muslim, and some of them are great and some of them aren't. They're like any other doctor.
Well, see, I remember when Jerry Falwell was in the process of shuffling off this mortal coil, and there was a quote about his health status from a doctor of an obvious Middle Eastern extraction. And you had to ask, you know, well, what's he do? You know, what's Jerry Falwell doing? What's Jerry Falwell doing in a hospital? And two, what's he doing letting one of those Muslims that he hates so much work on him?
Yeah. Well, it's just like ACLU. They don't mind using. He used them as well as Limbaugh.
Sure.
And keep on talking about them.
Well, because they're a convenient whipping boy, exactly.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'll let you go, and you have a wonderful weekend.
And you too, Juanita. Always good to hear from you, dear.
Okie doke.
All right. And I'll see if I can't come up with a few more fun words.
Okay. You still got that sushi thing?
I do. I do indeed. I saved it.
It was a bad time. My son said that was bad timing.
We'll talk to you later, Juanita.
Okay, you take care.
Okie doke. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Hey, Preston, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Good.
I loved what Juanita was just saying. That's Juanita, right?
Yes.
About cannibals not being so bad. You know, we've got this impression of what they're about. That's often kind of shortchanges them in many ways.
Well, and again, it's one of those cases of histories or ethnographies being written by the white people.
Yep.
You know, yep. Captain Cook was eaten by cannibals on Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Well, did anybody bother to mention what it was that Captain Cook did to get the cannibals so lit up?
Yep.
You know, you just sail into the bay and, well, I claim this in the name of the king. You all get out of the way. Oh, there's a dart in my neck.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. There's a magazine, she might be able to find it on the web, called Cultural Survival. And they study a lot of kind of indigenous groups that still remain around the world. Really interesting stuff, for sure. And along those same lines, I cut out a little article in the paper years back. It was titled Neanderthals, Not So Neanderthal.
Yeah.
And it goes on to say that Neanderthals might not have been as savage as we think. A 200,000-year-old jawbone discovered in France suggests that the primitive hominoids took care of each other, in this case feeding a toothless peer, an international team of experts said. And it talks about, you know, again, it's that impression we've been given of our species. And for the elite are trying to get us to accept their pathological violence in the world as just inevitable. And that's how we are. And certainly, you know, they don't want us to protest it, or to, if we reject it and don't go to their wars, they'd be screwed. It would be done. You know, war is over if you want it to be, I think John Lennon said.
Yeah, and it'll soon be time for us to play Happy Christmas, War is Over. Yeah, the wonderful little Christmas carol that he and Yoko did.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah, let's push for ending this war in Afghanistan. That's being ramped up. You know, earlier, a couple of years ago, Obama said something like, you know, we're air raiding villages and killing civilians.
Right. Our military strategy needs to be something more than just using air power and killing civilians or killing wedding parties or something like that. Yeah.
And Hannity really seized upon that, and he played
Our military are noble people, and if they kill civilians, it's because they had to nobly kill them.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he plays it, and then he's just aghast. Can you believe he said that? I mean, Obama isn't the only one saying it. It's human rights groups. It's unembedded journalists. It's Karzai, you know. They're
sure
talking about it.
Yeah, because it's all working out so well. I couldn't help noticing the story the other day, Preston. of the two little girls who were on their way to school. Did you see this?
Oh, the acid?
Yeah, when they were sprayed down in the face with acid and blinded.
Mm-hmm.
Civilization is on the march.
Mm-hmm.
Not.
Right. And again, that's getting a lot of attention and shock, and it deserves it. But so does us dropping phosphorus weapons on people. You know, there isn't the same upset or certainly the same discussion about it. You know, it's, you know, they make us upset when we hear about car bombs. We talk about those, but 500-pound bombs that were made at the Raytheon plant a few miles away.
Oh, those are good bombs.
Exactly. And I noticed that the U.S. is building, our power elite are building a more air bases in eastern Afghanistan to have some more of these Reaper drones flying around, taking out wedding parties and other threats to Western civilization. This is really getting, it's so bizarre. I mean, we have soldiers, quote unquote, sitting in computer rooms in Orlando with a joystick operating these things. And taking people out, just blips on the screen. Bizarre.
Well, it's just a video game.
Yeah.
And, you know, that way, if the plane crashes, you know, you got two more little planes blipping down in the lower left-hand corner of the screen. And, you know, it's not game over. Just time to put another plane up.
Yeah.
Because there will always be more brown people to murder.
Yeah. And, you know, it's ironic. I mean, this is big government. This is the real threat of government out of control. You know, the right wing's concerned about social spending and teachers' unions and healthcare for everybody. That's terrible, big government socialism. But this massive military complex we have, plus the private contractors, plus all these security agencies, the CIA, the NSA, which is even bigger, the DIA, ICE, DHS, and not a word. That's big government that they are totally comfortable with. And I noticed recently, just this week, the CIA was advertising their hiring. But I noticed they were advertising to on this right-wing station, KNUS, which is the Salem Radio Network station.
Yeah, and, you know, Gene brought that up a couple of days ago out in Portland, that he heard he heard advertising for, you know, a challenging, rewarding career. Do you thrive in fluid situations? Yeah, stuff like that. And it was on the Air America affiliate.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe we can get some progressives to take those jobs and infiltrate them with peace and love, as I heard someone on another station say.
And I also heard I heard from our buddy David in Tennessee, who said that it is a regular staple of on one of the sports talk radio stations in his area for the CIA to advertise.
Okay, I was just at my local post office and, as I was leaving, I noticed a poster on the wall, a military, sign up for the military and get health care and education and a regular paycheck and education for your kids and housing. And again, it's a sort of socialism that I think with the, you know, we shouldn't have the standing army sort of socialism so much. I mean, I'd like to go the other way with our socialism, the universal health care and stuff like that. But we'll see. I think there are efforts in that direction. Obama, a couple of years ago also, actually, you know, he's been talking about, you know, it's a shame. He's been pressured and feels compelled to, you know, want to grow the military himself and, you know, take the fight to Afghanistan, and that's been a setback. But at the same time, you know, he's also been talking about maternity care, you know, and other, you know, not tough guy stuff. I don't know if you caught it, but this weekend on C-SPAN, they replayed a book talk that he gave about 4 years ago regarding Dreams of My Father. And it was really interesting. You know, this is before he was even going to run for president. And somebody in the audience asked him about running for president. And he was like, I'm sorry, but I rank 99th in the Senate ranking right now. So I don't think I'm going to go there right now. And he also brought up, do you know his story about his dad going to Indonesia and him going there when he was 6 years old, going to a Catholic school in Indonesia?
Don't think so.
Well, it was right on the heels of a military coup backed by the CIA. And Obama said this. He was like, you know, I went to Indonesia and there was a democratically elected leader there named Sukarno who was overthrown in a coup by the General Suharto. And
yes.
It was backed by the CIA. And he said, and 500,000 people died or were killed. And he was like, and I was 6 years old at the time, and I didn't know about all this stuff going on, but I've since learned about it. And he said this in the context of a question about U.S. foreign policy and its aggression in the world. So he wasn't, you know, he laid it out there, you know, some hard facts. You know, another massive tragedy, injustice that we've been involved in. It's really interesting talk. And he's a good guy to have in the White House for sure.
I think he will be. But it's and right now I've been proven so wrong because you know I hear a right winger say something nasty and I just want to get right down there in the gutter with him. And his ability to not get sucked into that is quite stunning, really, Preston.
Yeah.
And as such, I'm questioning my own judgment about my judgment of his judgment right now. And, you know, maybe this idea of surrounding himself with people who disagree with him. You know, we had 8 years of yes men going, yes, boss, yes, boss, yes, boss, yes, boss to George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's got something, maybe he knows something that we don't. Although
yeah.
I also understand the issue of making, you know, Hillary Clinton Secretary of State might be a little too much of a lightning rod, but, you know, dadgum, it's his cabinet. He can form it.
Yeah.
I really didn't want Robert Gates to stay, and I am pleased to see that I saw some comment saying that the likelihood of Robert Gates remaining is about 10% now.
Okay. And I'm still hoping for Robert Kennedy to get an appointment to the EPA.
Well, see, that's one of those things that comes into play if Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State. Somebody has to fill her seat, and
okay.
There would be, and I would think that the two primary contenders in the state of New York for that would be Andrew Cuomo and Robert Kennedy Jr.
Oh yeah, that's true.
So, you know, it's chess. It really is. There's, you know, three or four moves that flow out of the first one.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's hope, you know, aside from those appointments, you know, let's hope the people.
You know, maybe one of the great Jedi mind tricks that Obama could make would be to offer Secretary of Silly Walks to Joe Lieberman. And completely neutralize him and get somebody into his seat that could actually be meaningful and go from there. I can't imagine what the conversations must be like right now for the transition team.
Yeah, very interesting for sure. I can imagine. I guess Chuck Hagel might get something, a Republican. You know, and finding those Republicans where you can, you know, don't agree with them on a lot, but maybe in some parts of policy there's some points of agreement. You know, there's a Republican in Maryland, I think, Roscoe Bartlett. Do you know that guy?
Not enough to be able to speak with any coherence. No.
But, yeah, I think a, you know, representative from Maryland, and I saw him on C-SPAN giving a presentation on peak oil issues.
Yeah. Okay. I saw that presentation. I didn't put the name with the topic.
And some people feel it's kind of a manipulation of the oil industry to, you know, say create the scarcity and jack up prices. And I don't know. I don't think so. You know, I think this is a finite product that we're using at a million barrels a day or some outrageous number like that. And nevertheless, I mean, whatever your feelings on the peak oil theory, you know, what he's suggesting as a response to it, I think, is very progressive. You know, and he's talking about renewables and mass transit and community design, new urbanism, and so on and so forth. Oh, I read about a new energy approach just today. Apparently, if you we can utilize the heat that's created on asphalt, to heat water pipes.
Yeah.
Provide hot water through, the hot streets. And I guess we're laying another 1,000 miles of highway each year or more, maybe 10,000 miles.
Yeah, you'd think we could do something with the heat captured that way, sure.
Yeah.
So, there's fascinating stuff out there. And, your mention of the whole peak oil thing, what happened to it? It reminded me of something just a second ago, namely, I'm struggling. Let me work backwards on this real quick.
Okay.
Let's see, peak oil. Oh, yeah. The classic case of right-wing lack of any ability whatsoever to work within a logical framework. I saw where the wingnuts the other day were screaming Barack Obama will shut down offshore drilling with an executive order. Oh, gasoline was nearly $5 a gallon, and now it's down to $2.24. Oh, and that's because we said we'd think about drilling on. And there's a Latin phrase in the logical world called post hoc ergo propter hoc. In other words, after this, therefore, because of this. And it's a fallacy, and I've mentioned it a couple of times on the show recently, because it seems like the Republicans are up to their multiple little chins and turkey necks in post hoc ergo propter hoc. One doesn't follow from the other. It was, if anything, it's proof of the oil company's willingness to manipulate the American public.
Mm-hmm. Again. They're doing the same thing. Obama's going to shut down the coal industry. And they play a clip of him talking about how expensive it can be to try to build a new coal plant. And let's hope it is. But again, it's, they just present the fear and, oh, it's going to cost you your job and you're not going to have any light bulbs. They can never present the solutions, the approaches, any of that.
Well, and I love the right wing response. For instance, the thugs in the coal industry, Preston. We say coal puts a lot of mercury into the environment, and mercury's not good for women of childbearing years, and we've all got a bunch of mercury in us, and women, the mercury accounts for a 10-point IQ deficit in any child born, yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
You know what the coal's response is? Coal industry's response is, well, there's mercury in them compact fluorescent light bulbs you're fond of. How you feel about that now, liberal?
Mm-hmm. Not good. So we're going to move on to another.
So we'll find a way to fix that, too.
Yeah, the LED lights, apparently. But I'm glad you mentioned it, and we should take precautions with them. And Dennis Prager, just today, he scoffed at the idea that coal plants are killing people. He's another guy. He's also always defending, telling people not to worry about secondhand smoke and stuff like that. But yes, coal kills people. Hardy har har har. And that's it.
But that's okay. They'll probably run some Friends of Coal ads on his program, and mm-hmm. he'll be able to afford a new, giant automotive penis extension.
Exactly. You know, the American Lung Association says that coal kills people. And, Yeah, I mean, China, there's some story today about China and the brown cloud they're swimming in day after day and the problems it's causing. I mean, disregard for human life and health from the so-called pro-life, the sage. He fancies himself quite the learned sage, and he's just the arrogance of this guy, Dennis Prager.
He's a semi-educated idiot is what it boils down to. Or as we say, just enough learning to be dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
But it all goes back to that Chris Hedges article, which talks about, you know, the ability to encapsulate thing to infabulize things. Ooh, now there's a word. To create these narratives that are all form and no substance.
Infabulize things. I like that.
Yeah, I'm saving that for if that shows up in the New York Times crossword puzzle on Sunday, I'm going to feel like a real daggum somebody.
Great.
That's Enfabulize, in case you want to use it in your next lightning round of Scrabble.
Yeah.
And you get the Z in there, and I think there's a double word score.
Yeah. And they certainly infabulized the free market theories of Milton Friedman.
Well, sure.
And I saw Bush the other day all dressed up talking about how we have to maintain the faith in the free markets and that let government intervene too much, but please give us the $750 billion plus some other
money. Yeah, I love this. You know, faith in the free markets. Faith? Faith? I didn't know that this was supposed to. Well, you know, it's his administration. Everything's faith-based, but I thought the whole genius of the free market was that it was rock solid, dead certain, carved in stone. This is how it works, because by golly, Milton Friedman done figured it all out for us.
Yeah. I mean, he made his own millions off of some big government tax, you know, for that stadium he had. And so, I mean, the hypocrisy is amazing. And I was thinking about what you were talking about last time we spoke about the damage he is doing and his administration is doing on their way out, and it's huge. And I mentioned something about how maybe there's something to him that can do something good, and I do try to search for that every now and again. And I thought of a couple things.
Okay.
I don't know if he's going to do this on the way out, but something he did earlier is that he recognized C-SPAN as a very important form of communication, and he gave Brian Lamb an award for helping teach the U.S. population about government and whatnot.
And again, even in that context, what Brian Lamb does, it goes back to this idea that we're sitting around. We really, as Kate noted, we've gone back to a much more ancient way of passing knowledge along because we are devaluing literacy. Now, I'm going to be the last person in the world to say that, you know, we need to prop up or bail out the newspaper industry, because the newspaper industry has failed largely because it got away from being in the news business.
Yeah.
But our decreasing literacy in this country is shocking. And it does not bode well for our future. And in fact, it bodes a greater likelihood than any of us would care to admit that Mike Judge was right when he put together Idiocracy. We are, evolution is not an upward progress. It is an outward progress in response to stimuli. And if we de-emphasize the need for literacy, we're de-emphasizing the need for a whole lot of the things that you and I take for granted as being a functional part of our culture.
Yep. And, you know, Beavis and Butthead very much, you know, were a commentary on that. I agree. But, you know, I mean, again, Obama, what he was saying on the campaign trail, you know, put away the video games. You know, don't get rid of them entirely, but, you know, put them away and read to your kids and things like that, spark your kids' imagination again. And the way we can do that through art in the schools and poetry. I'm sure people are picking up on that. In fact, when he talked about, and he talked about this less frequently, he only just mentioned it as an aside, but it got a lot of attention when he made that comment about checking the air in your tires. Apparently there's a huge boom in tire gauge sales, and people are doing exactly that. So, he's moving people to act already in helpful ways. And, again, maybe some people checked out C-SPAN when Bush mentioned it. You know, the Heritage Foundation and other corporate think tanks have a lot of space on C-SPAN.
Sure.
American Enterprise Institute, all kinds of right-wing, ideologues. But, every, one in four programs will be something that I think tears a lot of that stuff down. We don't need equal time with them. We just need some time. And it's there on C-SPAN. I'm looking for every weekend. I'm looking forward to our book TV.
Yeah. Now bear in mind, though, all time is not equal, Preston.
Yeah.
Because what you put on at 3 a.m. does not have the same force and effect.
True.
As what's running at 6 p.m. or 8 a.m.
That's true.
And that's, that's another area where we need to sort of pay attention. It's the same thing that happens to liberal talk radio, in that the right wing says, wow, liberal talk radio can never, it can't win in a head-to-head competition with good, honest, upstanding, God-fearing, patriotic right-wing radio. But then you sort of look behind it. And you find out that what happens is these head-to-head comparisons are between a 50,000-watt blowtorch and a 5,000-watt flickering candle flame.
Yep.
And no, we can't win. We can't win that way. By the sheer weight of numbers, the signal reaches more people.
Yeah. Well, I guess we need 500 of those little 1,000-watt stations, If we can't have the big blowtorch, we can have a lot of...
little tiki torches. I like that. That's in a way what you're seeing developing. Now there are people out there who are going the traditional terrestrial radio route, trying to get more and more stations. Randy Rhodes, Ed Schultz, the Mike Malloy,
Tom Hartman. I guess
Hartman's
reaching out to some of those stations that were carrying Bill O'Reilly, but he announced he's leaving radio in a couple months, so. He's approaching them and getting some.
So he's, I didn't realize that. Everybody was predicting it, and it came true. Yeah. O'Reilly was a bust on the radio.
Yeah. I think he's also kind of getting worn down by this progressive movement. I mean, he still does the show on Fox, but there are times when I think, he's tempered a lot of his arguments.
Give him another year or two, he'll be back to covering Britney Spears.
Yeah, yeah. And, if we get another attack, that'll be a real opportunity for authoritarian elements of our society. It's kind of like what's going on with the Taliban and groups like that and fanatics, in the Arab countries. They do something horrible, but we leave out the context so oftentimes. I mean, they are a traumatized people in so many ways. Or take the Afghani militants. I mean, 10 years of Russian army savagery, that will create savages.
But yet even the Taliban sat down at a religious conference sponsored in the last couple of weeks or so, I think, by the Saudis. Now, this is not the same one where they sat down at the UN and they sponsored and the Saudi king sponsored the forum on religious tolerance, which was, that part was laughable, because they're the most intolerant, religiously intolerant country on earth. But the Taliban, whatever the Taliban actually is, mind you, said that they have renounced all their association with whatever Al-Qaeda actually is.
Right. right. What the Taliban is a lot more complex than the, you know, emotionally potent oversimplifications were given of them, for sure.
But don't be, you know, don't be surprised, especially if you start seeing, if you start seeing the Obama administration begin to move away from this view that, you know, this philosophy that when all your problems look like nails, all your solutions will look like hammers. If we start moving away from that and start moving toward engagement, start moving toward dialogue, start moving toward a recognition of what our policies do to people who are otherwise powerless and desperate, don't be surprised if maybe one of these button pushers gins up some sort of an attack.
Yeah, there's
because if you look back, for instance, at the Clinton administration, there were repeated efforts to get Bill Clinton to engage militarily in that part of the world because that gives those people life and power. It confers power upon them. That's why George Bush has spent 8 years being a great big Uncle Osama wants you recruiting poster in that part of the world.
Yep. It's like a standard operating procedure for when there to be a ceasefire called between the Israeli government and the Palestinians. The Israeli military regularly starts bombing the Palestinians in hopes of provoking them. I mean, there were just half a dozen Palestinian killed.
Sometimes these aren't so much these aren't so much combatants as they are mutual needling societies.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, it's the IDF, the military establishment there, needing to, you know, be attacked so they can justify their existence again. And, it's a horrid cycle, for sure.
Oh, we talked a little bit last week about these two films about Che Guevara. Have you found out anything more about those?
No.
I mentioned them to you?
No.
I saw that one mention at Crooks and Liars, and it all just went, and nothing more. But I haven't anticipated seeing a movie as much as I, well, probably since The Lord of the Rings came out. And yes, that makes me a very shallow person, I know.
That was Chase Doc, right?
Yeah, Chase Doc. One's called The Argentine, and the next one is, I forget what. But it just looks to be brilliant. It does.
Yeah.
Oh, and you mentioned the cloud of filth over Asia. News Ninja Gene shot me a story in the interim from the Telegraph of the UK.
Mm-hmm.
3 kilometer thick cloud of pollution hangs over Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Apparently it can make its way across the ocean, too, and it's affecting the air quality in the western U.S.
Sure it does.
Which is the western U.S. is once again on fire. And that's another thing that's deeply underreported, these wildfires that keep taking, they're like perpetual. And
well, but see, in the word itself, you know, this is not me criticizing you, but, you know, you just got caught up in the frame. They're wildfires.
Yeah, right. Okay.
There's nothing wild about them. They are naturally occurring events that are made worse by the profound desire to overpopulate an area of the country that's not supposed to be densely populated.
Yep. And also, these droughts are often taking place. I don't know. They're going on in Australia and in Greece. And we've always had fires, and sometimes they can be useful. But these are, I mean, they're so intense and occurring so much more frequently. You know, they're very much people think it's a sign of global.
Well, it's part of the dry. Some of this is part of the dry out that comes as a function of profound changes to what is identified as a typical Mediterranean style climate that has dry summers and wet winters.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the summers are getting drier. That means you're going to have more tinder. But you also have more tinder because the forests, to the extent that they existed, have been removed. Forests take care of undergrowth because the forest, because the upper forest canopy limits the sunlight that can get to the stuff that turns into this dry, tindery stuff that has a flash point of apparently, you know, room temperature.
You know, I think I heard that Obama might be reaching out to McCain, maybe on some environmental issue. I mean, McCain has recognized climate change. I mean, he wants to push nuclear power, but, you know, that he at least says there's an issue there and that our own Department of Homeland Security has classified climate change as a security issue.
Mm-hmm.
That's something we can utilize when trying to broach these subjects with people who disagree with us. You know, actually, Tom Tancredo, who I cannot stand in so many ways.
And I know that's hard for you to say, Preston.
Yeah, well, I heard that he actually was part of a hearing, congressional hearing, along with Cynthia McKinney. I mean, talk about your odd couple on the Congo a couple of years ago when McKinney was still in office. And I don't know what his agenda was, but still that he was even there hearing these voices of the suffering there. Again, it's there. We can use these figures to broach these topics with people we disagree with. And, you know, I think that's part of Obama's, you know, approach to his communication and this nonviolent communication that he's practiced so well and it worked so well. You know, and I, you know, I probably shouldn't have said those mean things earlier about Dennis Prager, but I must say he's really been bad recently, and he's constantly on Obama's, you know, just degrading him. And but I guess even him, we have to recognize people isolated, and this is the only voice they've got. You know, they get something out of it. I mean, he can say some interesting things on religion. He has studied a lot of interesting books, and he'll have on a person from the left like Chris Hedges, which I respect him for that. And he'll give him space to say his piece. So he's not all bad either. And I guess that's basically what I was saying when I said there's got to be something about Bush, you know, that's decent. And, it, you know, I think his wife actually has been a progressive influence on him. She helped put back solar panels on the White House. You know, we hear about how Reagan tore them down when
right.
Carter put them up. They went back up, and I don't think it was during the Clinton administration. I was reading in Solar Today a couple of years ago this article about how they went back up, and apparently she was an influence on that. And she also helped to create the Texas Book Festival of the Book in Austin, Texas. And I think it's Austin. It might be San Antonio. But anyway, she helped found it. It's 2 years old, and so who knows, maybe by the time he leaves office, he can go on and do like a Habitat for Humanity and instead have it be kind of like a green Habitat for Humanity, because his ranch house, which was a prop, you know, for his election, but that Crawford Ranch is
very green.
Yes, it is. And if we think something good about him, maybe it will encourage him. Nelson Mandela actually said something along those lines. I mean, he had seen people he knew killed and brutalized and raped, and, you know, 20 years, all those years of his own life in the cell breaking rocks, and he came out, and what did he do to his enemies, his former, you know, apartheid people?
Yeah, he practiced what a lot of people would recognize as the teachings of, you know, that guy.
Mm-hmm. And he said something like, you know, I try to think something positive about people, and, you know, maybe that'll encourage them to do something positive or something like that. Kind of like if you're with a kid who's trouble, you know, if you just constantly berate them about what they're doing wrong, they're probably going to do more of that. You start to believe all the negative stuff, and I don't know. In some ways, it's kind of, I don't know. But you're right. I certainly don't mean to minimize what you're saying about the damage that they're going to be.
Oh, and I don't think you are.
And there's also the distinction between Bush as a person and Bush in his institutional role. I mean, I think on a personal level, like a lot of kind of evil people in the world are probably okay, but it's the institutional pressures and cult and.
Well, see, Preston, I would not want to be George Bush coming to the end of the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about the presidency. I'm talking about, I mean, even the most shallow and callous of people at some point engages in some level of introspection.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been in so many ways the very definition of the hollow man, the empty suit. He's been the Gumby president. He's been molded and shaped and manipulated by forces beyond his control and in some cases beyond his comprehension.
I think Reagan was very much the same way, you know, only having a vague awareness of what was going on around him, but ideal for being molded and shaped and, you know, the actor who could read the cue cards from General Electric. And
yeah, who was a tool, just like a drilling rig or a die casting, pressing, whatever thingy. Just like in the old days of coal mining. Coal miners were, the humans were considered of less value than the mules that drew the carts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we see that in George Bush. And had he not committed so much manifest evil, he would be a tragic figure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at some point in time, every human being is called upon, I think, to examine what he or she is doing or allowing to be done through or in his or her name. And it's what you do when you realize that that's being done that's the real measure of humanity. And it seems that George Bush's response, if indeed he ever did engage in that level of introspection, was to say, well, let's do some more. You still like me? Still want to have a beer with me? Cool.
Right, right.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I'm informed via email from our pop culture correspondent, David in Maine. The Argentine comes out in December, and the second film, Che, comes out in January. So I have a feeling you have a much better chance of seeing these than I ever will.
I don't have enough hours in the day to get through all the movies I have in my Netflix queue.
Oh, my. But yeah.
I'll definitely try to check that out. I saw a fantastic one, actually, last night. Before I let you go, I wanted to mention it. It's called The Business of Being Born.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was produced by, of all people, Ricky Lake. And I'm not real familiar with their show, but I don't think
it. Well, it was sort of the Jerry Springer-esque, by the same token, she did some wonderful acting. My daughters and my wife simply adore a film that she made called Mrs. Winterbourne with Shirley MacLaine, and she turned in a very credible performance, and she also turned in a credible performance in a John Waters film.
Oh, Hairspray.
I don't think it was Hairspray.
Okay.
I think it may. I think it goes further back. Oh God, what?
If he did Hairspray, maybe he didn't do Hairspray. I don't know.
No. That's him. But no, this goes further back. I don't think it was Serial Mom. I think it was the one before Serial Mom. I'm not surprised. The Business of Being Born.
Yeah, and you could get a feel for it at, it does have a website, thebusinessofbeingborn.com, and it's a documentary about giving birth in the United States. And, some people called it one reviewer called it the inconvenient truth of childbirth and how low the U.S. ranks compared to other industrialized countries like Europe and Japan. And, you know, survival rates of the baby and the mothers and infections and stuff like that. And a lot of other countries, a much higher rate of using midwives, and not having, you know, the doctors and the, you know, p- people kind of, again, an institutional pressure for these expensive interventions and the synthetic drugs.
And two or three sonograms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the C-sections are getting hugely, they're becoming a huge proportion of childbirths. And
becoming that again, because there was a decrease.
Mm-hmm. And it's a major surgery. I mean, it works, and it's wonderful that people can do that when it's needed, but it's becoming overused, they're suggesting. And in fact, after the second or third C-section, the rates of infections and major problems really goes up. And, you know, Britney Spears, she's been utilizing C-sections, and I'm trying to be careful as I talk about this too, because there are probably people listening who had C-sections, and, you know, it's not dissing those, it's respecting people who've done that, but it's just expanding people's awareness of this other option that's been lost in some ways of midwifery. In fact, go back to Europe, the midwives were being treated horribly, I mean, oppressed by the rising medical establishment. I mean, midwives are the ones being...
In some benighted centuries, accompanied by, of course, our old buddy, the church.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Midwives
were burned as witches on a rather frequent
mm-hmm.
time frame.
Yeah, they're coming back. And this movie is just a beautiful, informative documentary. Ricky Lake hired this documentarian who she herself became pregnant while she's making this film, and then kind of traced her own pregnancy. And incredible program, and very critical of the pharmaceutical industry and the privatized hospitals who try to shove people out, and they don't want people there 12, 20 hours.
Oh, what? You're a high-risk pregnancy? No, you need to go to the next hospital down the block. We're all full up.
Are you doing it here? Make it 3 or 4 hours, 6 hours tops. And if you're not,
and of course, you can't. It's hard for me to think about this topic without mentioning and recalling for myself the birth scene in Monty Python's Meaning of Life.
They use clips of that, actually.
Oh, I see you have a machine that goes ping. Ping.
They integrated clips of that. The music was also great. They had this wonderful original music to it, and they also had like a song from Radiohead and a couple other just really good songs. And this also is very much connected to what we were talking about earlier, some of the manifest evil of the Bush administration and how they cut back funding for these clinics around the world for sex education.
Yeah. They got any condoms in there?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't have no more money. If they won't be giving out condoms.
But that's about to be turned around.
Hallelujah.
Sure. Yep.
And it comes back to something that was brought up last night. I think it was in my conversation with Dave from Canada. This idea of a planet that has on it women who are empowered to make their own reproductive choices is by definition, and this isn't theory, it's backed up by facts, is a better planet, and is a less overloaded planet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, and one last thing, actually. Anne in Arkansas, I called her. She called into your program a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Love the call, and I think she mentioned something about how she does graphics.
Yeah.
I don't know if she ever got in touch with you or...
Oh, we email periodically, yes.
Well, if she's interested in doing like some pamphlets for Head On Radio Network, something like that, I'd be more than happy to compensate her for her time, because I don't do graphics. I don't even have a printer on my computer, but if I could find somebody who is interested in doing something like that.
Oh, wow.
I'd very much like to, you know, collaborate with her on that, because I do a lot of mailings each day, and I definitely want to be able to include like a little pamphlet about the Head On.
Oh, that's brilliant, Preston.
So
I will see to it I was having a hard time hearing that day. It's Ang and not Ann, or A-N-G.
Okay.
But she emails to me periodically, and I love hearing from her. In fact, she's in the chat room from time to time. She's Franken Angel. And I believe she also has a either a MySpace or a Facebook or perhaps both presence as such. Franken Angel.
Okay.
I don't think I'm giving away any secrets out of school that she'd be, like, upset with me over.
I don't think so.
Yeah. And, but that's a gorgeous idea, and I really appreciate you bringing it up. Okay. So I'll wish you a very, very happy weekend, Preston. And
okay,
we'll be talking soon, I hope.
Sounds good, you bet.
Uh-huh.
Good night.
Bye now. Our buddy Preston calling from Denver. I'm going right back to the phones in a sec. Just got a note in from our pal Victor saying, I will recommend that you watch The Motorcycle Diaries, a story of the young Che and his friend's trip by motorcycle through South America. That is one of my absolute favorite films. The soundtrack alone is worth putting the film on for. The cinematography is simply beautiful, and the acting performances turned in are of the very highest caliber. I've watched that movie over and over and over again, and it is like I said, it's one of my favorites. And to see this compared with the later portion, an overlapping of that portion of his life with Che, portrayed by Benicio del Toro. By the time, you know, he grows the beard and he's got the big fat cigar sticking out of his mouth and stuff, that, I don't know about the rest of it, because that was the only clip that I saw. Whoever did the makeup is going to deserve an Oscar. It's like the posters you see. He looks like the posters. It's stunning. And, of course, Benicio del Toro never, he doesn't know how to give a bad performance. Let's keep it rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Am I on again?
You are indeed.
I told you, I'm never going to leave you in peace. I was in the chat room listening, and as I said when I came in, this place is addictive. And I said, I'm going to try not to phone in tonight. I have one mouth and two ears. I should listen twice as much as I speak. But then my fingers let me down.
Well, but every time you've got one mouth and two ears, so you should listen twice as much as you speak, as you note. I don't necessarily know that that's true, but let me throw another one at you. That great Southern philosopher Mike Cooley has written that if you were supposed to always watch what you say, I don't reckon your eyes would be above your mouth.
Pretty good. Like it.
He said it much better than that. I'll find the lyric version in a moment. But
The message is the important thing. Well, you know, I've been reading the news again today and looking at your president-elect. Possibly thinking of a Clinton in there, which is kind of worrying. And then you've got, old Emmanuel in there, which is extremely worrying.
But again, we talked about Rahm Emanuel. He's not in a policy position.
It doesn't matter. It's just the color of everything, the way it's going. And I'm not using the term color in the terms of skin. I mean, just the look of it, the way it's all going, for me, just watching what's happening is truly scary. To me, it's starting to look like the people who really run the U.S. need a nice, friendly face that everyone will give a break to, so they can just carry on how they were, you know. That's my big fear for the U.S. and for the world. I mean, the world needs, given the power of the U.S., the world needs a sensible fellow at the helm.
Yeah, and until such time as I get a call from the 212 area code that says, Obama, Barack on it. I kind of have to trust his judgment on some of this stuff.
Yeah, I'd love to give the guy a break, but I have a really bad kind of feeling.
The other part of this is I don't think we serve ourselves or we do ourselves any favor or we are intellectually honest with ourselves, Dave, if we buy into, because it was a right-wing myth, all that garbage about he's the 999,000 highest liberal that's ever drawn by, he's the god of liberals. You know, whoever happens to be running for president on the Democratic ticket gets labeled the most liberal member of, whether it's the Senate or the House of Representatives or the United States Governors Association or the Sunday School Sewing Circle. They're going to be the most liberal member. There's nothing particularly liberal about Barack Obama.
No.
Everybody says, he's got to rule from the center right. Well, he's already in the center. You're saying you want him to be a right winger so that you can just say, well, you know, we voted against him and we called him socialist and communist and stuff like that. But he's going to do exactly what we tell him to do. That's what they're saying. Do what we and it's frankly racist, Dave, for the right wing to say that. You know, do what we told you to do, even though we didn't vote for you.
But you see, the thing is, I've always thought that that's what Bush was doing. Whenever I saw Bush speak, I'm looking for the ventriloquist with his hand up his back. Because he's not, you know, I mean, he doesn't have it between the ears to run a country.
No, when they had, you know, and they didn't put him under oath or anything. When George Bush couldn't show up to talk about 9/11 to the phony baloney 9/11 committee without sitting on Dick Cheney's lap, you know, and we couldn't see it, there couldn't be any televising, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that was the day that I realized that, you know, he's a thing. He's a creature.
Yeah, oh yeah.
He's not his own independent individual self.
Mm-hmm.
He's putty.
And I wonder if any U.S. president can be. The pressures from all around. How can somebody sit in the White House there and not at least to some extent collapse under the pressure? You know, I mean, I don't.
Well, I don't necessarily know, Dave, that it's a function of collapsing so much as it is a recognition of what I said before the election ever took place, and that is any person who gets into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue somewhere along the way has made a deal with the devil on some topic or another.
Exactly. You know, here's my thought on the U.S. political system is, first you sell your soul, then you run for president. Because the only way you can run for president is to sell your soul to the corporate monster to get the money you need to run.
You know, there's that...
is really a serious problem with the whole thing.
Sure it is. But it's not something that is specific to the United States political system. I remember that wonderful monologue in Henry V on the night before Agincourt, where Henry V is saying, you know, God don't hold it against me that my father was a regicide.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I'm not saying it's exclusive to the American political system. I just think it's more obvious in the American political system.
Which
might be a good thing if you've got your eyes open.
And if you can recognize what the deals are.
Look at Tony Blair.
Sure.
Come on. A total sellout. Despicable example of a human being is Tony Blair. Evil to the core, in my opinion. That's what I think of the guy.
And started out with a lot of hopes behind him.
Well, no, he started out with a lot of BS behind him. He's never been anything but an evil, self-serving bugger, in my opinion. He never had any intention of trying to improve anyone's life. Just like Margaret Thatcher.
Well, but when I think about the beginning of Tony Blair, though, I think of, and this is probably not the place for the complete rundown of the failings of the Clinton administration or anything like that. But there was that, you know, bosom buddy, you know, we're both good liberal fellows kind of thing that he and Clinton had going on. And then Clinton goes out, Bush comes in, and you know, the next thing you know, Tony Blair is George Bush's pet poodle.
Yes, he is, because he's an opportunist. That's all he is. And now he's become a Catholic, and now he's claiming he's going to do something in the Middle East. Bullshit. Sorry, I'm on the air.
That's all right.
You know, ever listen to a band from the UK called The Jam?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, you know the song Going Underground? There's a brilliant line in that song. I've told my kids the day I'm buried, that's the song I want played at my funeral. Because I will be going underground. But there's so many things in there. That song describes my feelings about the world so well. You choose your leaders and you place your trust as their lies wash you down and their promises rust. That, for me, nails the political system perfectly in two lines of a song.
Well, there's a lot. There's a reason the couplet is such a powerful little artistic device.
Mm-hmm.
And there's truth in it, and that's
powerful.
And that's one of the things that does worry me out of all this, Dave, is that a lot of idealism
was pumped into this campaign. And it's some of what Chris Hedges was talking about in that essay that I shared at the beginning of the program. And he was careful to note the sloganeering that took place on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give Barack Obama a chance, and yeah, well, look at me, aren't I benevolent? I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt.
You have a choice.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm going to give it because I've got it to give. By God, I'm just that kind of guy.
Okay, I'd love to be optimistic. I really would.
And I want
to. You know, I'd love to say, you know, the good thing about him is at least he's an end to Bush and Cheney. That's a given. There's no way around that.
He is that, and some of the right rumblings are being made in terms of overturning these executive orders.
Yes.
Although at best, I think presidents might manage to overturn 20% of them. There's just such a volume of them. You know, every time the president goes to the men's room, there's an executive order about it, it seems. So it's a daunting challenge to undo all the administrative baloney that the previous president has done, and they come back to bite you in the ass.
They're good at that.
But I like the rumblings that I'm getting from on that front. He's going to have, and this may sound very negative and very bad of me to say, but he's going to have a Democratic Congress. And
that didn't help for the last few years.
Well, no, it didn't, because I have this sort of queasy feeling in the pit of my stomach that this institutional jealousy you and I were talking about last night is actually going to come back into play now.
Mm-hmm.
And you will see Congress jealously guarding its powers, because what you traditionally have is, over the years, Republicans try to expand the power of the presidency where Democrats try to maintain status quo or contract it.
Mm-hmm.
So that what he's going to have, if he wants to, the things that he wants to get accomplished are going to take a real tire iron wielding kneecapper, and that seems to be the definition of Rahm Emanuel.
I would say that was a really good description of him. Yeah.
And so
the problem there is if they're sitting down together and discussing stuff, that puts Emanuel in a very powerful position to try and influence the president, and that's what worries me. That knowing the way that guy is and some of the stuff that he's done over the years.
Yeah, but Obama's not George Bush. I don't think Obama is the tabula rasa that George Bush was.
No. I would agree.
Or the malleable creature.
For starters, I think Obama has a brain. So that's a good start.
I think he's got a big old brain.
But then he's got to choose to use it in the right way.
And I think
the right way being, for me, the right way being the way that benefits the most people. That's the right way he's got to use his brain. It's to benefit.
Well, he's going to, first of all, we know he's going to have, to a certain extent, his hands are going to be tied by what he is inheriting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure.
In
some ways, I think that the Republicans said, you can have this damn presidency. We don't want it.
And so he's going to have to go to work immediately on the stuff that is, you know, when you're in the canebrake. And the stuff is up in your face. It's hard to worry about the lay of the land 15 feet out. So he's going to have to deal with the economy. And that's going to be first and foremost. I don't think there's any way around it.
Well, it really has to deal with the banksters, which will deal with the economy. I mean, what's going on right now is insanity. It was put in place 25, 30 years ago by people who cared nothing about anything other than the amount of cash in their bank account. And, I mean, what's happening right now is all that wealth that the bankers and that all these people, these supposedly bright people have been saying was there, was never really there. And all that's happening now is everyone's realizing that it was never really there. It was smoke and mirrors, and the smoke's blown away and the mirrors are tarnished. Right now.
Yeah.
That's how I see what's going on right now.
Oh, look, the financial thing, this is a
This is an Amway business gone bad.
It's a Ponzi scheme that's blown up.
Yeah, pyramid scheme, Ponzi scheme. It's all a con.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to be right up on top of Barack Obama on day one. I mean, he's
already on top of him.
Yeah. So that the other thing that I think is worth mentioning, and I'll mention it again because I have previously, is that there's nothing in the way of a talent pool to draw from that doesn't have the Clintons' fingerprints on it in terms of experience inside the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And where Rahm Emanuel is concerned, while he gives me his DLC status and his, playing footsie with the Blue Dog status gives me the real creeps.
Oh, it does me. Gives me the creep.
I also have to recognize that he was an effective member of the Clinton cabinet, that his appointment ameliorates and pacifies some of the what are still obvious ill feelings flowing out from the Clinton camp.
Who the hell cares about the Clinton camp?
Who the hell cares? They're a significant portion of the Democratic base. That's who the hell cares.
Why?
Because he wants to run for president again in 4 years.
No, I mean, why are they? I mean, just look at the record. Okay, Bill was given a really hard time over a really, if you can declare a war based on a lie, then a blowjob is minuscule. It's
sure.
Ignorable.
But remember what I started out with, my misgivings about the Congress. I want a 60 seat Senate majority, a filibuster proof majority, and we're already in pretty good shape in the House as long as everybody works together. Bill Clinton came into office on January the 20th, 1993. By November the whatever, 1994, he lost the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't lose the Congress because his policies were bad. That's a theme that's being floated out there by the right wing. He lost that Congress because he and that Congress came to loggerheads. He had a Democratic Congress. And he and the Democratic Congress came to loggerheads, and it cost them both.
Yeah.
And America suffered for 12 long years over that.
Yep.
So
I agree with that. I just having watched all the stuff with
So I don't know how he. I guess what I'm saying, Dave, is I don't know how he doesn't pick Rahm Emanuel to be chief of staff because A. The guy's got experience coming out of the last two-term presidency that the Democrats had. And B, he also comes out of having experience as Nancy Pelosi's enforcer in the House. So he's going to be able to work both sides of the street. It would seem.
Really, what we're saying then is that he doesn't really care as long as he's got his job. He'll kneecap anybody as long as he's told to do so.
Yeah.
Now, that kind of person in government really worries me.
But who would you have in there otherwise?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, I know a fair amount about American politics because, given I live just to your north, and America really affects where I am, and it affects the whole world. But I don't know the ins and outs. Maybe as well as you.
That's what I'm saying. I think Rahm Emanuel was almost a default position.
Maybe.
I mean, but Obama is a smart enough guy, Dave, that he put him in the one position where he could be most effective and least harmful, most effective from a procedural standpoint and least harmful from a policy standpoint.
Yeah.
Because Rahm Emanuel is not the guy that Obama's going to go to say, what do you think we ought to do about the occupation? Or what do you think we ought to do about health care? Or what do you think we ought to do about anything? He's going to have an entire cabinet that's going to give him those answers. And then he's going to tell Rahm Emanuel to go ye and do my bidding.
Imagine the scenario, though. Obama goes over to talk sense to people in Israel, and he's sitting next to him. Or he goes over to talk to Palestinians, and he takes him with him. What the hell are the Palestinians going to do, sitting down with, at the table with him?
Do you really think Obama's that dumb?
I don't think he's dumb at all.
I mean, I wouldn't take the son of a member of the Irgun to sit down next to talk to the Palestinians.
He's in a position where he's the kneecapper. He might need to be there, and that would be a scary situation, I think.
No, the kneecap. His position as chief of staff is vis-a-vis access to the White House, access to the Oval Office, and enforcement of the presidential will in Congress. Whoever's sitting down next to Obama, if he goes to sit down with the Palestinians and the Israelis, for instance, will be a specified negotiator who is appointed specifically to deal with that issue.
Yeah. The problem with the political system, though, for me, is that there's all this kind of playing the odds and manipulation and stuff, where really, for me, if I want someone to represent me in government, I want them to be open, I want them to be honest, and I want to know where they stand, and I want to know what they think. And looking at him, I just find the guy scary. I'm just being honest here. You know,
No. I'm not taking issue with your misgivings. I'm trying to at least
bow to your superior knowledge on the American
politics. No, I'm just trying to put it in a context. This is the context by which I can at least not have smoke coming out of my ears.
That's not necessarily a bad thing, you know.
It is when you look at the other problems we face.
Yeah.
If I'm gonna sit and have a low grade hissy over every appointment, hell, I won't get to January 20th.
I know. I get so angry sometimes that I have to just stop. When I look at what's going on in the world, and I look at things like, you know, Africa's been screwed over by the British, by the Germans, by the Belgians, by the French, and it's continuing now.
Don't forget the Arab peoples. They did it too.
Yeah. Yeah, they were pretty good with the slave trade too, but the Brits really had it nailed. They had a really good system going.
The Dutch, don't forget the Dutch.
No, I'm not forgetting the Dutch. The Brits were the absolute.
No, my point is that everybody has at one time or another used Africa as a big sort of treated it in a sociopathic fashion as a resource pool. And, you know, of course, anyone acting colonially acts without conscience.
Mm-hmm. Anyone who acts corporately seems to act without conscience, too.
Well,
corporatism is
colonialism 300 years later.
Yeah, exactly. There's a really interesting thing on the BBC. This Sceptred Isle, it was called. It's the history of Britain.
Yes.
Very interesting.
I think I saw that.
I only listened to it on Radio 4 online. But it was a don't miss it, because it was very open and very honest and very analytical. And the more you hear about this stuff, in Ireland, for instance, I mean, one of the things that I found about all this terrorism stuff is that people in North America have no clue of terrorism. They're scared of it, but they don't. Why? I grew up with bombs going off all over the place from the IRA. I was 20 seconds away from one once, and in the town I was born in, two kids, the day before Mother's Day, were blown into oblivion by a bomb. And the nice thing that the IRA then did was set one up 200 yards up the road to catch the people as they moved away from it. So I understand terrorism. I lived in it. And North America has no clue what it means. It gets to the point where you say to yourself, if they're going to get me, they're going to get me. I'm not going to let this screw my life up. You do. You absolutely do.
Yeah.
And all this fear-mongering nonsense is just a way of enabling the powers that be to spy on people. That's all it is. It's an excuse.
And it's also a very convenient means for getting people to cede their personal sovereignty to an authoritarian overlord.
And not just that. It's a great way for the corporate monster to make money from video cameras, from...
Oh, sure. It's highly profitable. Absolutely.
...to move back to the U.S. and become private security there. You know, it's this really handy little thing. But if you really truly understand what it's like to live in a situation where you could quite easily be blown up. Like I say, I was probably 10 or 15 seconds away from one once. And there's a memorial in my hometown to these two kids on the day before Mother's Day. I know what it's like to live with bombs going off. Nobody in North America does.
No, we don't.
And the interesting thing in the UK is that all this Arab stuff is being used as an excuse to bring in draconian measures. They never did that when there was a real terrorist threat from people who were good at it. Because the IRA were damn good at it.
Right.
They never did this back then in the 70s.
Exactly, Dave, because I pointed out the same thing back in 2004 when Bush floated the trial balloon of, well, if we have another terrorist attack, we might have to suspend the elections.
I was waiting for that one.
And, you know, I had a little...
I said that to you.
I had a little low-rent hissy on the air back in 2004. I said, you know, dadgum. We had a full-on war going with Britain, and they burned down the Capitol and the White House, and we had elections.
Yep. That's why the White House is white, isn't it? It was black originally.
Yeah.
Due to the flames, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, such like that.
I know. No,
don't try telling that to a right-winger. They think they've got a real good little knee-slapper going for them. Now, we're going to have to call the Black House now.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And I'd say I have no problem with that. The Brits did that to you. They
made
it black. But that's one of the things they have to answer for, you know, back to a few minutes ago.
Sure.
You know, I mean, money was invented by the rich to keep the rich rich and the poor poor. And it's worked really well.
Any medium of exchange.
Well, you can have a medium of exchange that doesn't do that.
Well, I keep coming back to them because I'm fascinated with their history, what we know of it. The ancient central, the Mexica. The Valley of Mexico, where Mexico City is now. Their trade currency was cacao beans. And the more powerful you were, the more cacao beans you had.
Yep. And chocolate is a luxury thing.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. I once had, and I don't know what happened to it, they drank chocolate.
Yeah, it was a royal drink. Long before
it was ever a food, it was a drink.
Yeah.
And they drank chocolate, and they had these, it's a stick with a series of increasingly larger swiveling hoops on it. And you spin it in there, and it creates a froth, because they were, you know, like your modern Starbucks aficionado today, they were fond of their froth.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I want extra foam. Well, they actually invented a thing whereby they could have all the foam they wanted. Just put it in there and aerate it, and boom, there you go. But, you know, it was a trade good. It was also a monetary good. You know, gold, meanwhile, was the sweat. Probably the sweat, urine, blood, and tears of the gods. And then the Spanish arrived, suffering from a disease of the heart for which the only cure was gold.
They were suffering from greed, weren't they?
And that is the disease of the heart for which there is no cure but gold.
I know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's when people talk about racism and the like, I always say there's only one division on this planet. There are greedy people and people who aren't. That is the big division on this planet. Not
that
black,
is.
Not yellow, not white, not anything, not rich, not, well, rich and poor comes from that.
Sure.
But that's the difference. They're the two kinds of people. And this is one of the things that I say to my kids is, the evil bastards always win because they have no brakes. Decent people say, I can't do that and sleep nights.
Mm-hmm.
Where evil people say, I can sleep night, bugger it, I don't care what.
Well, it's the definition of sociopathy. I remember many years ago when horn
and
psychotherapist Rick Goodner called in.
The top.
Horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner walked me through, without me knowing it, the definition of a sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
And asked me, said, I'm going to give you a list of things, and I want you to see if you can apply any of these things to George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And he read me a thing, and I said, well, George did this. And we went through, like, then he said, Bob, these are the elements from the DSM-4 for sociopathy. It only takes 4 to get you classified as a sociopath, and you've nailed him on 8.
Exactly.
Yeah, true.
And I've mentioned the book called The Corporation to you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a movie, too.
Yeah, there is. There is. I've heard of that.
But read it. It did.
I will do what I can to get my hands on it. You've got to imagine for a minute just how profoundly rural we are.
It doesn't matter. The thing about the book The Corporation is it compares a corporation.
I might be able to get the public library to order it in for me.
Yeah, it's worth it, or get the movie, or whatever. Go, you know, order it online if you must. The thing is that it compares, you know, a corporation has the rights of a person.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So it compares the character of a person to the character of a corporation. And you're talking about sociopaths, but what this comes up with, if you look at the way corporations work, is that they are psychopathic in the way they operate.
Yes, because they
have no conscience.
They have no conscience, and that is the key element to psychopathy or psychopathology or whatever the proper word is.
Yeah.
No conscience because they have no mortality. And in both instances, that's why I say so frequently that I find the idea of a business ethics class or a corporate ethics class in, say, some highfalutin business school in the U.S., I find that class utterly laughable.
Well, it's military intelligence, isn't it? It's an oxymoron.
Right, because jumbo shrimp. Because the only...
You like George Carlin, too, then.
Yeah. The only obligation of a corporation is to make money for its shareholders.
Yes.
That's it. That's all. That they've got one commandment, thou shalt profit. That's it.
And that's it? Externalized cost? You know? Oh, God. The problem I get when I get talking to you about stuff, my head starts to kind of bounce around, and I start to have thoughts about stuff.
Oh, without a doubt, I fully comprehend that. I mean, the stuff that happens inside my brain is pitiable. I mean, I'm sitting here looking. You reminded me of something. Yesterday was St. Bryce's Day. Did you know that?
No, you got me on that one. I don't know who St. Bryce is.
St. Bryce's Day, November the 13th of 1002 A.D., was the day that Ethelred the Unready,
I know that guy, yeah.
Sent people about to slaughter every Dane in England. Now, mind you, none of the Danes were your typical Vikings. The Vikings had already bugged out, thanks to one of the sharpest satirists and most brilliant people on the Internet, Eugene Finnerman at FinnermanWorks.com. I know about this. So what he wound up slaughtering were merchants and artisans and tourists.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems, however, was that one of the people that got murdered was kinfolk to some of the folks back home in Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
And it's through that massacre that you wind up with King Canute.
Dane geld and all that stuff.
Yeah, which was ransom or tribute extracted from the English to pay off a debt in Germany.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we go back to paying off debt, don't we? You know, she crops up.
Well, there's your money again.
Yeah. Terrible stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, they had the Vikings had a very unsuccessful series of raids, I guess, down the Rhine, and wound up owing tribute to the Holy Roman Emperor, Kaiser, whatever, according to Eugene. So then they extracted it out of England's hide to cover theirs.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Hey, look, it's globalism.
I was just about to say the very same. You know, no, there's nothing new under the sun, as they say, you know. And all of this stuff, what is it? Is it that most people don't want to think? Is it that most people aren't capable of thinking? Is it that most people are easily, manipulated?
From my standpoint, Dave, it's context. Okay, most people don't put this into context. Most people, and this is not me ballyhooing myself. This is just, you know, my particular fascination, and that doesn't mean that the rest of the world has to be so fascinated. But it's, you know, if you have the ability to look at other things that have happened to other peoples and try to learn from their mistakes, for instance, if you're the Athenian Empire and you can, and you're Pericles and you can build a time machine, you will not sail off to Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you are the president of the United States in 2001 and you're a great big humongous empire that has just been, then I don't mean to diminish anybody's losses or anybody's suffering, but in the grand scheme of things, if it's 2001 and you have just suffered a mosquito bite on your ass, you do not sail off to Syracuse because that's what attacking Iraq was.
Exactly.
The Athenian Empire wound up fighting a 30-year-long war with the Spartans and a lot of proxy states, and in the end, the Athenian Empire fell. Not because anybody whipped them particularly egregiously, but because they bankrupted themselves.
Well, it's the old Pyrrhus thing, isn't it? You know, the Pyrrhic victory.
Sure.
You might win, but if the costs are so high that you just screwed yourself,
you can't afford the victory. Right.
Yeah.
Hey, Dave, I got to roll on. I got a couple other blinkers here that I want to hit.
Okay,
this being the last night of the week and all.
And you know, you'll hear from me again.
All right. I trust that I will, and I look forward to it. You have a great weekend, all right?
You too. Relax as much as you can.
Going to try. Bye now. Rolling onward. Let's see. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, I was calling you about the appointment of, I hope Bill Richardson to the post of Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what you thought about cabinet appointments in general with the Obama administration.
I'm in favor of them. No, I'm sorry. I'm being a smart ass.
I'd hope so.
I recognize, like I said, talking to Dave, that there is a talent pool deficit. It's we being Democrats, we're not just awash in people to put into positions. We don't have that authoritarian infrastructure that the Republicans are so very, very good at building and maintaining. You got to remember, you know, Rummy and Cheney are just old, hateful apparatchiks from the Nixon era. You know, Cheney went to Congress for the first time in 1968.
Absolutely.
And they've had him around, you know, and it just, whereas, you know, pity Bill Clinton. He had nothing to draw on. But
except his own talents, which were immense.
Yeah,
that's another story.
You know, he had, you know, at most he could have looked back to the Carter administration. Poor Jimmy Carter really had nothing to draw on. Because it was, you know, he was elected, he went into office in 1977, you know, he comes in and bang, there's the Burt Lance fiasco. So, you know, part of this is the problem that arises out of us not having the presidency very often lately.
Unfortunately, what was it like the last 17, or out of the last 17 elections, we've had, what, three? I could be wrong in my numbers, but we haven't had a whole lot to work with, that's for sure. And unfortunately, with the way the media is, with the thing that we have to work with as a country, especially now where we stand in the world, it's such a daunting thing that it's very hard to draw talent.
I wouldn't flinch. I don't think I would flinch with Bill Richardson as Secretary of State. I have misgivings about Hillary Clinton. But I also, as I said earlier, I also recognize that there's a chess game involved there.
Very true, and I think that they're definitely, I don't think anybody is quite sure what's on Obama's mind, which may be one of his strengths, honestly, going into this. And it's kind of nice that he's his own man, you know, Chicago politics being what it's being, and of course that's on its own aside. But I'm from New Mexico. I was born there. I actually live in southwestern Virginia, not that far, I guess, from where you are. But I know with him being an ambassador and with some of his other qualifications, I think with the also with the ties that Hillary Clinton has, as far as I'm not sure what you want to say, her what she might have done in the past and what she owes, it might not be the best thing for her to be in that position. And of course, what she has hanging over her with her husband, it might present a few problems more than it gives positives. And I wasn't very pleased reading about that today. So I think Bo Richardson would be a better choice. I'm not sure who I would choose besides, but I was curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, Bill Richardson is a good choice because as a governor, it doesn't create quite as much of a problem as it does bringing someone from the Senate, I don't think. Because sure. Bring in Hillary Clinton, there would obviously be a humongous power play to fill that seat. And I'm under the assumption that it would be the Democratic governor who would appoint the successor who would have to run, I guess, in 10 for a term of his or her own. I could be wrong on the timing of that. He did the thing with Rahm Emanuel. That's a nod toward the Clinton administration. I guess he's had a conversation with Senator Clinton about it.
Yesterday or today, I think it was.
Yeah. For some reason, I don't see it. It doesn't, and I'm not, it's not the personality politics and the Pumas and all of that silly garbage.
Sure.
It's just that it does, there's something, what a cop out this is. There's something karmically that doesn't work about it for me that I can't put my finger on. Given the choice, Bill Richardson in a heartbeat.
Between the two, sure.
Yeah. With her, I'm until he really, really puts his foot in it, I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. He can send me the Christmas card thanking me later.
All right.
Because, I'm just that powerful.
I can tell.
That's like I wouldn't want her on the Supreme Court. And it's now this is not anti-Hillaryism. I wouldn't want Hillary on the Supreme Court because in her lawyering days she worked for a law firm that made its bread out of screwing widows and orphans and making life easier for employers to stomp down unions and things like that.
Sure. And a lot of people had the same misgivings about them. Well, maybe not the same, but similar misgivings about John Edwards when it came to him being president. My Republican law school ex-girlfriend, notwithstanding, ambulance chaser, I guess, is the thing that I was talking about. And, of course, you're talking about a lot more past dealings with much more powerful people with Hillary. I think the one.
I guess I don't know why she'd want to leave the Senate.
I certainly don't think it's a move that would benefit her. And honestly, I think that's why she's being so coy with the whole thing.
If you gave me ultimate power, I'd pick up the phone right now and say, if it's up to me, ma'am, if you don't mind, I'd like to see you replace that dude that wears the magic underwear from Nevada, Harry Reid. I'd rather have, honest to God, I would rather have Hillary Clinton as the majority leader of the Senate like that. Because I don't trust Harry Reid to get the job done.
I don't either. I don't think he has the personality and charisma, not much less the support of the opposition and the Senate to get anything done. And honestly, I'm not sure I could say much more about Nancy Pelosi, but that's another story.
Well, Nancy doesn't worry me quite so much as Harry does because Nancy's got a comfy little majority to work with.
That's
so true. That means she can marshal the votes. This is going to take a Clausewitz level tactician in the Senate, especially if we don't get to 60. Now, nobody wants Saxby Chambliss out and Norm Coleman out and the Ted Stevens out more than I do. I want 60 people in that Senate, and I want the Republicans told to sit down and shut up. And then you got to have a nice little heart-to-heart talk with a horse's head in the bed with people like Ben Nelson, who is actually more conservative as a Democrat, more right-wing as a Democrat, than some Republicans are.
How close are we, and you're definitely more in touch with this than I am. I'm not sure how close we are to a veto-proof majority. I mean, I know it takes 60. The last count, I think it was 56 or 57, and I know we've still got a few seats that are still out, like Coleman's. So where do we stand as far as this?
Begich has come ahead of Stevens. In fact, Stevens' own pollster has said that he thinks Begich will win, so that'll push us to 58.
That'd be nice.
We're
definitely very close.
Saxby Chambliss and Jim Martin are a whole new election on, what, December 2nd in Georgia, the runoff? And they've already got John McCain down there on the hustings. So, but, you know, as long as there's an election, there's a chance. Meanwhile, however, Georgia has already disenfranchised, 50,000 people to keep them off the voter rolls, and I don't think that's going to be solved by December 2nd. So that's got to be overcome. Minnesota, the Norm Coleman did every dirty thing under the book, or under the sun in the book, to try to get reelected, and yet, you can tell that things are not looking good for him by the degree to which the Republican Party is screaming their fool, pointy little heads off, hollering, "The election's being stolen, the election's being stolen. Look there, Minnesota's got them. See there, they got them, a Democratic Secretary of State. See, they're stealing the election." And going so far, in fact, to point out that it's just like if Catherine Harris was Secretary of State in Florida in 2000, a tacit admission by a well-placed high-up Republicans that, yeah, Catherine Harris stole the election in 2000.
Well, they can raise the flags all they want, but I think with this particular election year, it's hard to raise flags when truth, I think, finally is coming out, and hopefully we'll win the day.
I think you're right. I hope you're right. Oddly enough, I'm looking here at the total, and it's 57-40, and of course that's 97. So that I assume that total does not include the three. I'm assuming that 57 includes Bernie Sanders and Joe Lieberman.
Very true, absolutely. And I'm not sure where the Joe Lieberman thing is going, honestly, at this point. I'm not sure. I mean, I think we're all not sure where his loyalties stand. Obviously, it's being questioned right now. I know Harry Reid had a talk with him, but I don't know if that was a positive thing or a negative thing as far as where we stand 6 months from now, especially.
Well, Harry Reid came out, and I thought he was almost ready to apologize to Joe.
I was pretty scared.
And I think that's part of why all the nicey-nicey's being made. Now, Pat Leahy of Vermont has come out and said that that Lieberman should be stripped of his chairmanship. I don't like Lieberman chairing a committee with that kind of oversight over a presidency whose patriotism he openly questioned. I think that's just sick.
It is. It's absolutely.
On the other hand, if you can extract a promise, and frankly, I'd make it be written in blood,
right,
from Joe Lieberman that he would not filibuster any significant legislation, and that he would not try to stonewall the attempts to get legislation through. Maybe the better part of valor is to let him keep that committee chairmanship and then then neuter him some other way.
Yeah, and that's one of those things I guess you can do through the dirty workings of the underside that we don't normally see on the .coms in the news and
right,
the blogs.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, and you're absolutely right. I think I think in the end, he will come through for us on the votes that count. I just, you know, you got to wonder when it comes to foreign relations, you know, where you've already got. And as you discussed earlier, I don't think that the choice of Rahm Emanuel is a bad choice at all when it comes to foreign affairs. He just, in the position that he's in, he doesn't have any real direct effect over that. And I think he'll be a very good interface with the Congress. But when you have those choices already made, where are things going to stand? I guess we won't find out until Obama makes the list of his.
Well, the economy is going to be is going to be the thing that's right in front of his face, sure. And right behind that is going to be the Employee Free Choice Act, health care, and these stupid little wars. And they're not little wars; they're big occupations, and they're killing us. We're getting bankrupted over it.
I think right now they're small in terms of the focus of the American people besides those whose loved ones are dying.
Yeah, that's why I'm ashamed of myself for just having said that.
Elephant in their room, that is the economy. It's not even the elephant in the room. It's definitely the elephant that you know in the room and sitting on your George Washington's right now.
Yeah, well, exactly. So, you know, where Lieberman plays into that, I think Lieberman would be more than willing to be a fly in the ointment on things regarding the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan and anything to do with the Israelis and the Palestinians, because, you see, Joe Lieberman is a bigot. Joe Lieberman has never met an Arab that he would not prefer to meet dead. He just is. He really, really is. So, you know, with that in mind, that's where he worries me the most. He's got a decent record where some other arguably liberal stuff is concerned.
Sure.
And that is not as concerning to me in terms of him voting the right way, but it's the Supreme Court and it's foreign affairs where I think he wants to continue to exert himself. And yet, you know, this guy has less than something around a 20% approval rating in his constituency in Connecticut.
Right.
So, you know, his days are, and that's Democrats and Republicans together. So his days are numbered as of his reelection, and that comes up in 12.
Too far away, politically speaking.
But I love the sneaky little idea of maybe making him Secretary of Silly Walks in the cabinet.
I hadn't heard of that. That's probably a good idea.
Well, that's because I'm the only one that's propounded it thus far.
I see. Well, actually, my this is the first time I listened to you tonight. I used to listen to independent, radio streaming, progressive radio for a long time, and my opportunity of internet connection unfortunately got a little bit limited. But I was a big proponent of the horn, and I'm glad to hear you on it. And I was very impressed by listening to you. That's why I gave you a call.
Well, I appreciate it. And a name, please. I didn't recognize your voice, but I wanted to make sure that I wasn't forgetting someone.
Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't identify myself. My name's Cliff Thomas, and I live in Iron Gate, Virginia.
Okay.
Right near 20 miles from the border of West Virginia.
Okay. Okay. Well, welcome aboard. You're welcome to chime in anytime. We look forward to hearing from you.
Okay. Well, I enjoyed it, and thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely. Thank you for making it.
Absolutely.
All right. Have a great weekend, Cliff.
You too.
Bye now. Okay, we'll run over by a couple of minutes if you guys are still there on the line. Okay, you're not. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello.
It's Ange.
Ange, how are you?
I'm cool. My computer at home is totally weird, and I still can't get the live chat, even though I've, like, downloaded the Java. I know. And I've been a computer person since the 80s. Well, Mac. I'm a Mac person since
right.
The graphics. But I still can't get this chat thing going on my computer, because I think it's corrupt. But anyway, I don't want to talk about that.
Okay.
So many things are going through my mind right now.
That's kind of what happens to me and the whole program.
Sometimes I can't even relate because I'm more of a visual person, so so I can't relate of all the things that are going through my mind.
Sure.
And I've had a couple drinks, so bear with me.
That's all right. I'm about to, too.
But it's Friday night, so I'm...
That's what they're... That's what Fridays are there for.
Yeah. I work hard.
Yes.
So, that guy, Dave, from Canada.
Yes.
Steph, I totally... Well, I'm kind of with him with the Tony Blair thing. Tony Blair sold out. And I never actually knew. You know me. I'm kind of the artist floaty. But I've been trying to get in this political stuff for the last, 3 years, and I've tried. And, Tony Blair did sell out.
Sure he did. No, I wasn't disagreeing with him about it.
No, he did. I mean, look at, Andy Export, still shaking the Bush boss. It's a free CD. I did the cover. You can, it's like totally free, non-profit. But I think about, remember that October 6th interview you had with the Bugliosi guy?
Yeah, Vincent Bugliosi, sure.
That was my favorite. I have that saved.
Oh, wonderful.
I love it. And what's going to happen? I mean, did that, what's the lady that was going to be elected?
I don't think she got elected.
That is not good. Because if things like that don't happen in our, quote, free democracy, free, government for the people world, what's going to happen next?
I know.
What is going to happen next?
One of the things that we're hearing all this talk about, who's going to be secretary.
Realize this. What is going to happen next? They're going to let everybody get away with everything.
That's the fear. That is the fear. And what I was going to say a minute ago is that we keep hearing about, who's going to be this and who's going to be that. The one thing that we haven't heard a lot of is who is going to be Attorney General of the United States.
Yeah.
Because who is Attorney General of the United States has a lot to do.
And I'm not as smart as you, but that's why I love you and love all your callers. I've been listening to you guys, and I haven't called or anything, but I love you guys because you guys are the best as far as I'm concerned. And I look it up, and it's right on. There's no false news here.
We try to just give it as it is, because
and I like it.
It doesn't have to. It doesn't have to be manipulated.
Why other news sources here in the United States of America isn't like that. Because I thought the people ran our government. It blows my mind. It blows my mind.
It's an attempt to do what we're supposed to be doing. And that is participating in our form of government. And it starts with talk, and hopefully the talk energizes and enervates and empowers action.
But most people don't feel this way. They don't. I mean, I work with people every day that just like tells, they tell me, I tell them what is fact, and they tell me, oh, that's conspiracy theory. Or they give me, I don't even like to talk to people on an everyday basis, most of the time, because they have no idea what's going on.
No,
I don't have the linguistics to speak the intelligent talk, I kind of know what's
going on. Nah, you're doing just fine.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
And I'm working on your stuff because I think it's great. Because I love that stuff. I love that kind of artistic. I'm more into the visual, I suppose. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
But the thing that really bothers me, you know, when I was listening to that Bugliosi thing on October 6th.
Yes.
I think I emailed you something, but I'm like, what is Bush going to do when he leaves term? Is he going to run? Is he going to run and move to another country to...
Well, they did buy all that land in Paraguay.
to avoid the prosecutions of the future, or what the hell is he going to do? I think about that shit. And I've been thinking about that stuff since then and before then. I don't know. It's just, it bothers me that someone can get away with murder.
Mass murder.
I know. It bothers me. It really bothers me. And the American people, most American people, they laugh at me when I tell them this. Of the few people I even...
Well, to be fair, Ange...
Usually don't speak of this shit.
No, but to be, Ange, to be fair, the people you're talking to, you're not exactly in a haven of liberalism. You're in as liberal a place.
Conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
But Ange,
that's the response that they've been trained to give you because they're paying attention to the right-wing drivel that's being pumped out there by, you know.
It's ridiculous.
With lots more force than anything we're doing.
I mean, you know, when I've heard you guys talk a lot about that book by Frank, What's the Matter with Kansas?
Yeah, Thomas Frank, sure.
I go way back from the guy that helped him, I mean, and toured with him with that book.
Oh, wow.
And, back from, like, you know, the late 80s. But not with Frank, but with a person that actually, my age, that actually toured with him back then. It's kind of a famous anarchist. But I'm not going to mention names. But that really, like, when you mention that book, it just, and you, I know you mention that book a lot, but it really strikes a nerve because it's like people are so stupid they'll believe anything.
Well, they've been trained to be that way, Anne.
I know they are. And I know you're brilliant. And I'm actually pretty dumb compared to you and a lot of the other people.
No, not at all. Don't.
I am. Because I can't convey my talk as far as, you know, what you call it. Because I'm an artist, but I feel it inside of me. And that's why I love you guys. Because you talk about what I wish I could, you know, talk about. Because I've never been very much a talker. But I mean, since I've discovered you guys, it's like I love you. You're like the heart of what I am, the heart of me, in a way. And I love everybody, you know, Amber and, you know, Kevin and Albert. Oh, I love Albert. And all the guys, Dave, that British guy from Canada. And then I just love all you guys, everybody. I can't, you know, I'm not a name person, so, but I love all the callers that call. And I know it's just awesome to hear somebody that can actually speak in a way I always wanted to speak, because I've never been able to do that, but I love it.
Well, I tell you what, you're welcome. Yeah, you're welcome anytime. And don't run yourself.
I'm gonna do your art, and you're gonna love it.
It's going on, Ange. It's going on my hide. It's gonna be great.
Ooh.
Yeah.
On your butt?
No. Probably up on my shoulder.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You can't do the butt.
Nah, that's too much.
Yeah, you have to do it. Well, I've given tattoos like back in the late 80s, when I had a bunch of punk skinhead / punk friends.
Yeah.
Since I was the artist was a hand engraver, they made this tattoo gun that they all delegated me to, you know, give tattoos to people. I don't have a tattoo myself. But, you know.
Well, I just figured it's time to do it. And
I always like to give pain before I receive it.
You know, I'm one of those really, really boring people who doesn't want to give it or receive it. But for this, I'm going to take one for the team. I figured if at the tender age of 45, it's about time that, given the effort that we put into this thing, I'll put it on the skin.
But you know what? You know, it's like I've never had anything I'd want on my body for the rest of my life, even though I respect people that do and always have. I think if you can find something that you can put on your body and love it, go for it. That you won't regret it. And I've always felt that way. It's like, I guess I don't have one because I've never had anything that I wanted to put on my body for the rest of my life. Even though I respect people for like over 20 years that have, but long as you don't get to be a junkie and addicted. I've known those people. It's like they get one tattoo. Okay, I know I'm going off a tangent.
That's okay. That's okay. Not to worry.
You know, like Wanda or, I don't know, one of those chicks were saying the other day, sometimes you need to get off on stuff that's, you know, not even...
Oh, yeah. You know, like, yeah, that's why we started the show tonight talking about Walmart Bingo.
But sometimes you need to do what you need to do, but... I've known these people since like mid 80s. And when I was a cool teenager back then. But as old I am. But it's like they get these tattoos and then they get something to cover the tattoo they had. And it's like, actually, I know this guy that had so many tattoos and he had this one tattoo that was like an 8-ball. It was so big, he made it an 8-ball. And then he didn't like the 8-ball, so he wanted a bomb, a big, big, gigantic black bomb on his arm. And it's like, what are you going to do with a black bomb when you don't like it?
Well, I know. And well, that's, you know, that's...
Yeah,
that's
addictive.
Well, that's like the people who, when they're young and thin and everything, they... And fit and svelte, and they're 20, and they get the cute little bunny on their tummy, and by the time they're 40, it's a camel.
Yeah.
So you gotta be careful.
Yeah, but I don't know. I guess I've always been smart in that way, and it's actually better to give pain than it is to receive it. Is what I've learned.
Yeah.
From my homemade tattoo. You know, and it was just like a group of friends.
Sure.
Someone made a homemade tattoo gun, and since I was a hand engraver artist, they delegated me, and they had to like con me into it.
Yeah. Well, do you do? I've looked at your website and stuff, and you do some brilliant design, gorgeous design.
I do a lot more stuff that's on my website because my sister gave me that website a couple of years ago because she's like a brilliant. She's a brilliant, like, software writer,
mm-hmm.
And she kind of gave me, I guess she kind of pretty much secured my little name that I've had for years, Frankenangel.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done a lot of stuff with it here lately because I'm so busy, but the one thing I have done is I put your link on it.
I saw that.
That Agony of Gaia.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, stroke my heart. It's fucking beautiful.
It's.
And I worry about our natural resources. I worry about the beauty of what is America. I mean, my friend Andy from England, Andy Export, just emailed me today, and he's like, I want to come on holiday. there in Arkansas because it's so much space and it's so beautiful. England is becoming such a crowded place that there's nowhere to, you know, to be found. And I want, you know, Arkansas. You know, I think about Virginia and the coal mine hills and
sure.
Virginia. But then I think about Arkansas, and if they screw up that, what are they going to do here? I don't know.
Well, when it comes to the extraction industries, Ange, if you've got something under your dirt, it'll be there sooner or later if we don't stop them.
I love to go up in the hills and the mountains where there's no one else to be found for miles and miles.
Yeah.
I don't want to see, you know, torn up desert-like resources in the hills, and it breaks my heart to think that these gritty, rich...
Well, one of these days, Ange, you'll have to get yourself over here to the into the hills and see a little bit of what's left here because it's beautiful and it's striking. Ange, I got to roll on, dear, because I ran over a little bit. But you have yourself a wonderful weekend. All right.
Hey, you know me.
Yeah.
Here in a couple of minutes,
I'll lift one and I'll toast you.
You know what you can do?
What's that?
On your one of your little play an Andy Export song.
I need to do that. You know, and I'm gonna email with you about that because I went to his site to try to get it.
I do vocals on a K7 thing, which is an Andy Export side thing, which is actually like if anybody likes music and remembers the cassette generation from the old punk cassette generation from the 80s.
I'm one of those people.
MySpace. And anybody can participate. It's beautiful.
Cool. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. You and I will email a little bit over the weekend. And in the meantime, take care. And
I love you. Agnes is the luckiest woman in the world.
She might take issue with you, but
she better not.
I'm pretty lucky, and I'm the lucky one out of this thing, Ange, because it's a strange and wonderful relationship. I'm strange and she's wonderful. You take care and have a good weekend. All right.
But she's wonderful. I know that.
We'll talk soon.
She has to be beautiful. Can she talk about her like she's a goddess? So. God. Well, all right.
All right.
Later, bye.
Take it easy, Ange. Bye now. And, frankenangel.com is the website if you want to see some of her work. It's gorgeous. And I've run over by a little bit, but I let Ben Birch know. And so he is taking care of it accordingly. Podcast will be up. That's the end of the programming week. But it is not the end of the programming. Because the weekend is on its way. The weekend that will bring you the Rick Smith Show, Rick's Place with horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner, Night Sounds with Billy Shears, and separately, Help Me, I'm an American with Rama, followed back here on the horn by All Foxed Up with John Fox, and hoping for something really, really cool, keen, and happening this weekend, because something cool, keen, and happening happens every weekend on All Foxed Up. Thank you, everyone, for participating, however it is that you so do. Your emails, your calls, your thoughts, your participation in the chat room. By the way, the message boards are back up at headonradionetwork.com. Take advantage of them. Make use of them. That's another means of participation that we try to provide. Of course, there's blogging there as well. And I thank you for everything you do to keep this going. And I don't know if I can ever adequately express how much we do indeed appreciate it. If you haven't yet and you feel like participating in keeping this going, there's a happening little PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com. It's easy, easy, easy. And you can also contribute via snail mail at head on 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, that stands for Personal Mailbox, 318 Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. Thanks to Peter Godbold, thanks to John Fox, thanks to Ben Birch, the hardest working men in liberal talk, and Ben being the king of that group. WhiteRoseSociety.org and Ben Birch make sure that this stream goes out. And it's a level of labor that is almost incomprehensible. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. It's hard work they do, and it is bravery that is called upon from them to do it. And they do it, not for themselves, not just for the region, but for the nation and for the world. Because more than anything else, they know, living and working where they do, that indeed we are all downwind and we are all downstream. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.